All right, welcome to Joel Radio, everybody. How you doing tonight? This afternoon, whenever you listen. I say tonight like it's night. Like it's anything resembling night. It's probably the earliest I've ever recorded a show. And that's not a bad thing. I'm not mad about that, but it probably is the case. Because I got a great guest. Are you an early riser? Is that?
Maybe I'm up at 6 a.m.
Oh, my God.
It's dark. I love it.
Oh, you must have some career that I don't, because I'm... He does. He has a tremendous career. We'll talk to... I got a great guest. You know, last time on the show, before I wrapped it up, I teased about how good of a guest I had, and I was so excited. And then I also said, well, if you just hear some dumb comic here, you'll know that guest fell through. But no, the guest is here. It's Steve Miller, my friend, author, journalist, covers true crime.
Indeed.
And mostly, right? Or would you, is that your stock and trade?
I guess, you know, in terms of books, yeah.
Yeah, in terms of books.
Journalism, it's, you know, it's everything.
Rock and roll?
Rock and roll.
Because I talked about, you know, I did a whole show, and I know you listened to a little bit about Detroit rock and roll and old stories. And while it was a good show, I'm not the guy who wrote the book on Detroit rock and roll.
Detroit Rock City.
You are the guy who wrote the book about Detroit rock and roll.
The Uncensored History of, yes.
Yeah. It's a great book. I just read it. I read it over 2 days. Watching
2 days.
Football, yes.
Oh, that's pretty good.
Yeah, I watched football and I read the book in between plays and finished the whole thing. It was great.
You know, when I did it, when I finished writing it, when I remember the exact moment when I stopped, I said, okay, it's done.
Yeah.
And then I sat down and I waited for about an hour. Then I read it in one in one night.
Okay.
And I got done. I said, well, I'm pretty happy. We can stop now. I don't even need to release it. Because I'd always wanted to read it.
Right, yeah.
It's the only way I...
Well, it's tremendous. There's a lot of stuff on there. We'll get to that. And then, of course, I met Steve. I guess I can say this. We met at the Gathering of the Juggalos. You were covering it.
At the seminar tent.
Yeah, at the seminar tent.
You handled the stage, which goes on a 90-degree angle, 45-degree angle.
At that venue, yeah. The land is not level there. It's very hilly, that venue.
I think I kept asking you, what's up with the stage?
Yeah.
You know, and there's no answer.
I don't build the stage. I just run it.
I know. And you're there, but you're there.
But Steve came around and asked me a few questions, and we talked, and then we met again and talked, and then we rode home from this year's gathering together.
That's right.
We went from Columbus to Detroit together and talked, and probably talked about a lot of stuff we're going to talk about on the show today, but it was a really fun conversation. And, of course, I've read Detroit Rock City since then, and you've got a new book coming out, and we'll talk about ICP if you're into that. And
sure.
And I think, you know, I know that people are like, oh, I don't want to hear him talk about ICP. And then there's juggalos that will listen to the show just to hear me talk about ICP.
Is that right? Why wouldn't they want to hear about ICP?
Well, there's people that hate it. You know, there's people that... Well, and that's why I'm glad to have you here, because you are the ultimate... Because people say, well, Joel, when you talk about it... You know, you have those, you know, you're on the payroll.
I was just going to say,
and
check from them.
Yeah, you're in there and you're buddies with them. And of course, you're going to say nice things about ICP. You're going to say the gathering is a cool event and all this stuff. And we'll get into that, because you're a guy who certainly walked in there and wrote what you wrote. And people can read that online.
Sure.
I have. And
sure.
So anyway, let's get into what you're up to now. The new book, which is great. Tell everybody what's coming out on December 1st.
Murder in Grosse Pointe Park.
Yeah.
It's a book about the murder of Jane Becerra. Her husband, Bob, was convicted for his role in that murder. And the book chronicles pretty much the whole thing from the start to finish. He was convicted late last year of first-degree murder. He's appealing. And inside, I mean, I talked with Bob Becerra quite a bit while I was writing the book, in fact. And he and so included in the book are, you know, my conversations with him, my emails that I exchanged with him.
Yeah.
And it's quite a case, because, as you know, Bob Becerra had a alternative lifestyle, BDSM lifestyle. He was immersed in that. And he the prosecution in the case alleged that he wanted to ice his wife so he could go hang out with his BDSM girlfriend.
Right. Now, and so this story has a lot of what great stories have. It has, you know, sex, murder, money. I mean, Grosse Pointe Park, although that is not, refresh me, that's not the real high-end Grosse Pointe, right? That is sort of the...
Grosse Pointe Park actually is, yeah, I mean, let's put it this way. You drive down Middlesex, he lives in Middlesex. It's a beautiful street, okay. A lot of beautiful homes. And in fact, in the book, it talks about how it used to be that avenue in particular was the home of a lot of the organized crime people.
Oh, okay.
In Detroit.
So he's a rich guy.
He was the son of an state appellate judge.
And
so he came from some form of legal aristocracy.
Wow. So basically he's in this relationship with another woman because he has this secret, but the wife that's killed Jane.
Right.
She is his second wife, I believe, or
she is. It's true.
She's his second wife.
That's right. He was married briefly when he was young.
And she is not. Now, I guess there's no way to. Maybe there isn't no way to. But you did the research. She was not involved in that alternative lifestyle at all. They didn't meet that way or anything.
No, not at all. Jane was when I do these things, I do these studies of the characters in the books. And Jane Becerra was an upstanding person with a fine family. And she was actually a very good person.
Okay.
And so often when I do these, you always find some sort of skeleton or some sort of like, you know, this person. Not Jane. She was really really.
Because see, right there, it seems like, well, if you're a guy and you're getting into a second marriage, why not pick a woman that's in that lifestyle? At least now, you know, you're later in life. I mean, Becerra's, I don't know when they met, but Becerra would be in his 40s probably when he married her, yeah?
No,
he was younger than that?
For many years, so it's for several decades. So so it wasn't like, you know.
He could have gotten into that after he married her.
In fact, I'm pretty sure that's the case. Ugh. Yeah.
And, of course, now everyone in Detroit knows this story because... You know, it was originally a murder for hire. That's what you think, and that was the way that, you know, people thought he did it, but then it was, this handyman guy.
Yeah, well, yeah, Joe Gentz, the handyman. Well, it turns out that he hired the handyman, and these are the facts laid out in the case in court, so I'm citing everything that's laid out. He hired the handyman, Joe Gentz, to kill her, and Gentz did it, and then Gentz runs to the cops and goes, okay, I did it, but this guy made me do it.
Ugh.
So Gentz, of course, ends up in jail. And so Becerra, Bob, goes, well, I guess I got to kill this guy that just, you know, narked me out.
Yeah.
And so he starts trying to set up a hit with some local yokel handyman or like some local yokel appliance salesman.
Yeah.
As if this guy can do a hit.
Right.
And
he's in jail already, yeah, Joe Gentz.
Gentz is already in jail.
He has to go kill a guy that's in jail.
Right. And so, and they say, oh, it's easy, you know. But anyway, when he goes solicits this guy, the appliance salesman, he says, hey, listen, can you help me put a hit out on Gentz? That guy, the appliance salesman, runs to the cops and goes, hey, this guy's trying to kill this guy in jail. So he wears a wire and busts Becerra trying to solicit it.
Yeah.
And he gets 8 years for soliciting, but then after a little while, they build the case. The Wayne County Prosecutor's Office built the case.
And the case is actually the case against Gentz, right? Or it's against Jane is what he's...
But the case was against Bob. That's
against
really
Bob,
went.
But for...
They knew Bob was ultimately responsible.
Right,
for
Bob is actually in jail for killing his wife now.
Yeah, he's
not,
in jail
not
for
just,
Bob.
I know they held him for the...
Yeah, he's in jail. He's in jail for, he's
well, that's the thing, is that he you don't want to say he would have gotten away with it, but he sort of did get away. In a sense, they didn't have the evidence to bring him in from Gentz because Gentz has a low IQ or something? Is that
initially,
right?
Initially, that was the concern, was that Gentz wouldn't make a reliable witness. but during that time, though, I mean, they had a lot of time then. They began building this case.
Yeah.
And they came through with a pretty good case against Becerra for, you know, that he did. He caused the murder of Jane.
All right, and let me tell you, if this sounds on some level boring or not entertaining to you, go find some video or at least photos of these guys, because it literally looks like a Coen Brothers movie.
These guys are
bizarre. Like Joe Gentz looks like he walked out of, looks like John Malkovich from a movie or something. He just got this weird palooka dead eye look.
He looks like that guy from Sons of Anarchy.
Yeah, okay, there you go.
Yeah.
And then Becerra is just kind of this big, greasy, you know, so dirty looking, like fat.
yeah.
con artist looking guy. Yeah. What did he do for a living, Bashara, before?
He owned some properties. He was a, okay. he was a you know, kind of a rental. I mean,
landlord.
His, yeah,
kind of
and
guy,
his,
yeah.
His wife had a really great job.
Okay.
With an energy, it was an energy company, but and she had a great job. But Bob kind of just piddled about, and he like rented to these low income people,
yeah.
and so on. And he had though his big deal was he had the he had that piece of property where it was that beautiful that oyster bar was over there, right off of here we go. This is why I need my notes. And
Jefferson,
I
was that where it was?
I think it was. Yeah. It was near Jefferson. But at any rate, he had one nice piece of property, and but he leased to mostly low income people, and you know that was his job,
right?
And I don't know how much money he made. I mean, they said he made very very little money. The yeah. exhibits in court did. Yeah, they aren't always accurate, but
yeah. Because he could be hiding his money, too. People are paying him in cash or something.
It's so true, yeah.
Know. Now, and then the, so the thing, and then, so then let me just ask you this, because the S&M thing came out because, what's the timing of that? Like, does that come out because they thought that that was somehow tied into this, like she was murdered in an S&M thing? Was that ever a theory?
Well, the funny
or?
Thing was, is after she was found, they found her in her SUV in a crappy area of Detroit, and they found the body, and then, you know, in that interim period, they found that Bob Bashara in one of his properties had a... had a little, I guess we'd call it a little chamber for BDSM activities.
A dungeon.
I guess we could call it a dungeon. I don't know why I've never liked that word. Dungeon,
well, okay,
but,
well.
But at any rate, it's the basement room for his okay. his sexual activities. And it was underneath this bar. And so he was, and so they found this, and that hits the news because yeah. somebody tipped him off because right. Bob was not very discreet.
Yeah,
and so then we get this whole thing cascading. It's like, okay, now the BDSM thing is right. Bob's into that. He's got a girlfriend, and he again when I started interviewing people, they said, well, Bob would just drive around with this woman, mm-hmm. Rachel Gillette, who was his girlfriend. He'd just drive around with her and hang out with her. They'd go shopping at the store together and everything, and. He did very little to masquerade.
So he didn't hide it, and then no. and then the because the thing is, you know, people would want to think, well, you know, that, you know, in people's minds anyway, well, he's into violent sex,
right?
Therefore, he yep. that even makes him look more guilty,
right? They that's yeah. what the prosecution they wanted to connect that that tendency toward violent sex towards just a tendency toward violence.
Jeez,
you know, as a motivator, I guess. Sex is the great motivator in this case, I suppose.
And when you're doing your research, are people open in that community? I mean, can you find people to talk to, or do people not
yeah.
want their names released? Or like, how much discretion were people having, or were people completely out?
I was kind of surprised at the people who were really out.
Oh, really?
And they would
okay.
talk to me gladly and fill me in on the whole thing.
Well, they probably feel bad for Rachel anyway.
Well, they aren't criminals.
Yeah,
these guys, just because you're into something like that doesn't mean you're a criminal. And so, and I kind of thought, you know. They felt that this was casting a bad, you know, because they were focusing on one guy who went, you know, who kind of went rogue, but he was a member of their community. But, you know, they wanted to be clear that one guy does not really
My opinion, and I'm not into the BDSM lifestyle.
You aren't.
I am not, believe it or not.
Okay, all
this
right.
This is not a chamber or a dungeon.
See, I thought you said you were. That's why I'm here.
See, okay. I have equipment, but they're microphones and mixing boards.
I was talking to a member of the community, and this is going to get back to everybody. This is a community-friendly
book. You know, I've dated women who have been into that, and I've known that. And, and it always sort of, I always look at those people and you know, I dated this girl who had a profile on one of those, I don't know if it's a single site for that lifestyle,
yeah.
you know, community site. It's like a Facebook for perverts, basically.
Yeah.
And she showed this to me one day and I was like, well, I don't know. This looks pretty scummy to me. This looks like a world that I don't want to be in.
Right. Yeah.
You know, to me, I did not get good feelings from that. You know, I sort of got like, oh, this is a little sinister. This is a little, and me and that girl obviously didn't make it very far.
Right, after you see the wanted ad on one of those things.
Yeah, and I just went like, I mean, she shared it with me because she wanted me to know, but at the same time, it was like, oh, I'm into none of that, and I'm, and the fact that you are makes me not want to hang out with you anymore, and that's what happened. But I just look at that and go, boy, these people are, you know.
It's weird because they kind of let it take over their whole life.
Yeah.
It seems to them that their whole identity is tied to that.
Because part of me says, okay, that's normal, and there's people who, you know, if you're into that and you do it and whatever, but there are people that that's all they do and that's their whole life. And and that strikes me as like any obsession with anything.
Sure, sure.
When it overtakes your life, you just go, okay, this isn't healthy. Something's wrong with you.
Yeah, yeah. And if we believed, like as the prosecution said, that Bob Becerra was motivated to off his wife by it.
That could really be. And that's what they think the motivation was, to get rid of her? It wasn't a money thing? It wasn't a...
They pushed the money angle, too.
Yeah.
I mean, when you're doing a case like this, you're trying everything.
Yeah.
And with Bob, it was, he was motivated by BDSM. He had no money. So if they would have gotten a divorce, he would have gotten nothing.
Okay.
Broke. Oof. And that kind of thing. So, there were all kinds of... Right. And the book, the book covers all this, and then some of his other lovers and so on. And,
how many of those did you turn up?
A couple. I mean, there was a woman that him and Rachel wanted to have this three-way relationship with. She lived in Oregon, Janet Lehman, and she was very helpful to me.
Okay.
And she was cool.
She must have freaked out. But I mean, all of these women that were in any kind of relationship with him must have been, holy shit, this could have been me.
Yeah, yeah.
I could have been strangled by this maniac Joe Gentz.
And a couple of them, I reached out to, and they didn't return calls.
Ugh,
hard to believe.
I'll tell you this, Joe Gentz. When you see this guy,
he's a real character. You know, I talked to him on the phone.
Okay.
A couple times. I talked with his ex-wife. Talked to his mom. Talked to his brother. It's like I've talked to a lot of murderers, and he's just kind of, I don't know, he's hapless.
He's hapless.
That's a great way to put it.
Right. But what was the pay? Because I read this, I don't know if it was in the description of your book, but what was his payoff for doing the murder?
What did he get? Like $5,000 and a used Cadillac?
I thought it was $2,000 and a Cadillac. $2,000 and a used Cadillac.
Yeah, $2,000 and a used Cadillac. And the ugliest Cadillac. Okay. It didn't run, by the way.
Yeah, okay. Yeah. Oh, my God.
And so it didn't take much.
Yeah.
It didn't take much. Now, remember, he confessed, and then the thing was, he confessed. He says, the prosecutor's like, yes, we're going to get Becerra because he's going to testify. We'll use him and our evidence.
Mm-hmm.
And then at the last minute, he backed out.
Oh, jeez.
And he said, I'm not going to testify. And so, they were left with their evidence, which worked. But
okay, jeez.
But Gentz is a little, kind of wishy-washy, I guess.
Yeah, that guy is just frightening. I mean, I guess I know if you go, I've got to pick somebody to kill somebody, I guess you kind of look at him and go, maybe he does it, but maybe he's so dumb that maybe that's the...
They said his mental capacity is a little diminished.
Like he could have gotten a guy that would have done the job. Perhaps, I don't know. I'd kill somebody.
You don't do that either?
I don't do that.
Man.
But I'm saying if you wanted to hire somebody to kill somebody, you kind of go, just because this guy, you could fool this guy into doing it, may not make him the best guy for the job.
Right, yeah.
If you
found a dupe, just because he's a dupe doesn't mean, he's the right dupe.
So Becerra, to me, just seems like a guy that he wished, he had this master plan for getting rid of his wife, and then he used, if he had a great plan, he hired poor people to execute the plan.
Perhaps his choice of employees wasn't the best.
Yeah.
Remember, you saw him just a couple weeks ago. He was in court trying to get another trial, and which, he really still maintains his innocence. He called me a couple weeks ago.
Jeez.
And he asked me if I could call one of his investigators. So I forget what he wanted. But anyway. No, I would say, to me, it's like, okay, he was found guilty in a court. That's what our system is.
Yeah.
But he's going to maintain he did not do it. If he didn't, everybody's waiting.
Didn't his lawyers go to court and talk about what an idiot he was, or that he was trying to lead the investigation or lead the defense himself?
It's pretty common, though, for a defendant.
Bad client.
It's common for a defendant to try to say, listen, try this, and this. Because especially if the defendant isn't a lawyer.
Right.
He bought himself some more bad publicity when he put them on the stand.
Yeah, it's like, here's the people that are trying to get you off, and they're bagging on you.
Right, right.
Tough life.
they're paid to be his friends.
And here's something, and maybe you can confirm this with me, but this is a little note I made to myself. Is like, you know, these guys like Bashar, and maybe I know this because I dated that girl and saw who she was hanging out with. You know, that 50 Shades of Grey movie.
Okay.
That really gets it wrong, doesn't it? Aren't these guys that are into this and who are trying to... Isn't Bob Bashara like the typical... Isn't that the guy? Aren't they mostly old, fat, greasy guys?
These are people
that are pulling that are the guys that are the
in general
the dominant. You know,
in general,
the
these
dominant.
Are people you don't want to think about having sex.
They're not real hot guys.
Yeah, the guys especially.
You watch that movie, you read that book, and here's this rich business guy,
right? Yeah,
who wants to take some young woman under his wing, and he's in a 3-piece suit and stuff.
Right.
And these guys look like they're in wife beater T-shirts with barbecue sauce running down them. And
it's just like everything in the movies.
Yeah.
It's all the Hollywood version.
Yeah.
Everything's attractive.
Yeah. This Bob Bashara, believe me, if you think you're getting 50 Shades and you want a guy that's into that, they don't look like Christian Grey in the movie. They look like Bob Bashara. Look him up.
Yeah.
That's who's going to beat your ass.
That's
who you get.
If you're into that, yes.
Well, I had a girl on this show, and I believe me, I wish I had her in here today. She would meet guys. She told us a story when she came in. She said she met a guy at McDonald's. Like, she arranged to meet a guy at McDonald's and then went back to his place so he could spank her.
Really?
Yeah.
Now, did he have to pay her for that?
I don't think so.
That was just, you know.
I think she was into it, and he was into it, and that's where they met, and that's what they did.
They met online and said, let's meet at a McDonald's.
Meet a nice public place. They met at McDonald's, and then they went back to his. Now, she sort of, you know, I think she clammed up a little bit with the details.
Let's meet at a public place,
right.
And then so we can go back to my place right. So you can spank me.
And this is the girl, and this was as much information as she chose to share.
Yeah.
So you know there's other stories, but she thought this one was the one that sounded most palatable to the audience.
Oh, I want more than that.
I don't know. We spanked her here. Don't get me wrong. She was, you know, we
really? What'd she look like?
She's okay. She's okay. Cute. Yeah.
Right.
Cherry Brooklyn, if you want to find that show. Go through the archives. It's on there.
All right.
Got spanked. Me and Corey spanked her. I think Corey might have spanked her more than me. I don't know.
God.
But, you know, it was like, well, what are you into? You're meeting guys at McDonald's. I'm like, to me, just right there. And that's, I get what you're saying when she tells me that story. Like, that is not, you know, completely outrageous. And she claims there wasn't sex, that the guy spanked her and she left. And he, you know.
This is what I was told, too. They for some reason, that satisfies them in some weird
really?
Way. I don't know. It must be an emotional way.
I mean, I'm
obviously
like,
it's not a sexual.
And I think I was asking her. It was many years ago we did the show, but I was like, did the guy beat off at least? Did you at least give him that? And I don't think he did, or she says he didn't. I don't know.
Really?
I mean,
did he drop her back off at the McDonald's?
I think he must have. That I don't know.
She goes in there.
Did he buy her a value meal for letting him spank her?
Yeah,
anything.
At the least, you know?
Yeah, a caramel sundae. throw her a bone.
I'm thrown by the McDonald's, sorry.
Yeah, that's the thing for me. It's like, you know, you go to McDonald's and then you get spanked.
Yeah.
I don't know.
I don't know. Don't you have a couple drinks first?
No, I that's the whole thing is very weird.
Okay.
And you know what I mean? Like, and it's weird, too, in that if that sounds normal to you, then that's completely too weird for me. You know what I mean? But, like, if I let's say, you know, I placed a personal ad or answered a personal ad and said I want to have sex and give a description of what I want, and the person comes over and I have sex, that, to me, doesn't seem weird.
Okay.
Even. I mean, it's like, you know, two people get what they want.
Yeah.
And then you go, oh, meet me at McDonald's and then spank me. I'm, for some reason, that bothers me more.
We
you
have
know?
To reexamine all of our values and the whole thought process here now.
Yeah. So Bashara, and that comes out December 1st.
December 1st, it should be in the stores a little earlier than that. It's the perfect
Okay,
Christmas
Amazon
gift
has it listed. I'll link to that on the description if you go to joelradio.net.
Cool,
we'll link to the Murder in Grosse Pointe Park. And that was a big sensation here in Detroit. How much national traction did that story get?
I don't know. I don't think it got a whole lot. I mean, obviously the BDSM thing got some attention.
Right.
And so usually what these books do, it's not a Detroit book, it's a national book.
Right.
So Penguin is a big, a big distributor, publisher. So it's the Berkeley imprint. So these books, you end up, it's fun because, you know, I end up anywhere I am, I see the book in the store. So.
And actually, the fact that it wasn't a huge story could, in these true crime books, can that help the book? Because people don't know the story as
it
well
can.
As
very
Detroit
much
people.
So. Yeah.
Where people read and they go, holy shit, I had no idea this ever happened.
People
you know?
Go to the bookstore or whatever, they'll be surfing online. And, you know, usually true crime readers, it's not your first visit.
Yeah.
And so, you know what you like and you know things that look interesting to you. And so they'll see a synopsis. ideally, and they'll pick it up.
Yeah. You know? I mean, my dad reads a lot of these.
Really?
True crime. He reads a lot of like mob stuff.
Okay, that's a really big market.
He reads mob stuff, but okay. I think he would read this. Maybe I'll get him this for Christmas.
That's a good idea. Because these true crime things, I mean, they you can read them really fast.
Yeah, I don't know. But the one thing I do worry about is what his wife's, going to think. Oh, by the way, here's a book about how to kill your wife.
And that's the funny thing about the true crime genre is, anytime you go, it's kind of like it's the porno section of the bookstore.
It kind of is, yeah.
Because it's right. It's kind of this guilty pleasure for a lot of people.
Yeah.
Yeah, I read that, yeah. But to me, as a journalist, it's just an 80,000-word crime story.
Yeah.
But
do you feel like, if you find out somebody read, I read every book about every serial killer ever, you kind of go, okay, I guess you know how to do this now. I mean, is there a correlation?
Not even remotely.
No, because when you find these guys, like this Cleveland guy, I was going to ask you about him, Sowell, is that his
name? Anthony Sowell, yeah.
Yeah, and you wrote a book about him. Was he a guy that had true crime books? I mean,
no.
Is he? Yeah, see, that's the thing.
No, not at all.
There isn't that correlation.
Not
is
at
there?
All, man. No.
Yeah.
I mean, a serial killer is a whole other. That's just a mental disorder.
Yeah. But it's not a guy who had a stack of horror movies in his apartment
or something.
None of that.
No. I mean, Anthony Sowell was just he watched adventure movies and, and pornography.
Huh. Just that pornography gets you.
Which made him like anybody at BW3.
Wow. Thank God I don't watch pornography.
or you'd be afraid of me.
Oh, my God. Yeah. Thank God my books are filled with Beatles books. And
that's right.
The history of magic and things like that. Because
as we look around.
Yeah, I showed Steve some of my Beatles stuff. A very impressive collection.
It's really, yeah.
Yeah, it is. I got a lot of stuff.
Yeah. I'm kind of knocked out by that studio. The book.
Recording the Beatles.
The people that get into the Beatles, they're really geeks on the Beatles.
Here's the thing about those guys, and this is what if I won the lottery, because I wouldn't need to win the lottery to do this. Those guys that wrote that book were giving lectures inside Abbey Road Studio 2, meaning you could go and you would sit in the Beatles studio and they would basically do a live presentation of what that book is.
And would they demonstrate the gear?
Yeah, I think they would have some, and they would have some of the guys that were back that worked on those records back then.
Yeah.
And I go, that's what I would love to do more than anything.
That's
is just sit in there and listen to those guys talk and be surrounded by that. Sounds great.
It's just a Beatles geek out.
Yeah, it really is.
You know, I still don't get it. I still like the Rolling Stones.
You can like the Rolling Stones.
I like them much better.
I like the Rolling Stones. Yeah. Did you see that Keith Richards documentary?
I did.
Under the Influence. Very good, I thought.
You liked it.
I did.
To me, it seemed like just one big long advertisement.
For the new record, yeah.
Everything was all kind of set up. Everything was staged. And he's... He was annoying. I can't believe this. I'm saying this, but Keith Richards was annoying me. with his cackle after everything.
Is it too much like the fact that when you watch one of these Stones documentaries, they can cut to Mick or they can cut to Ronnie Wood, and here it's just Keith, too much. Yeah, I know what you mean.
But you know what surprised me is how good he could play.
Right.
I was totally surprised.
And
I didn't.
My two favorite sections of that were when he sat at the piano.
Yes.
Because I've never really seen Keith play the piano anywhere, and I'm sure. Bigger Stones fans than me would have seen that. And then when he talked about his bass playing on the Stones records and all of the tracks that he played bass on, Sympathy for the Devil and a lot of the big hits.
He would do
Keith on bass.
Because he would be in the studio late at night, Bill Wyman would be long gone.
Right.
And he'd just be there and he'd say, well, look, I can do this. And so let's just do it.
Right.
So Wyman would show up
to
do his part and he'd be like, oh, well, sorry, it's already done.
Yeah.
But it was an interesting.
Yeah, I enjoyed that. I mean, I could listen to Keith Richards talk all day. I'm actually a fan of that.
Okay.
I'll just listen to him because he's entertaining and he'll tell crazy stories that you've never heard. And I thought the documentary was very good for that. So
I'm like a lot of people. Any Stones has to focus around the '72 era.
Yeah, that's your thing.
Just a lot of Stones people will say that.
All right, well, let's get into Detroit Rock City because that's certainly right up my alley. Now, this book came about. I read your intro. Tell people how you got into writing this book. And cause I know when this book came out, I didn't know you then. But a lot of my friends were talking about this book when it came out. It was a big deal in Detroit anyway. So.
Right. It did nationally. It did really, really well. And I was surprised at that. I think because people like things that are about Detroit.
Mm-hmm.
And so... I started writing. I mean, really, I wrote the book because I I always wanted to read it.
Yeah.
That was my main thing. Is I kept, you know, I knew about it way back. You know, somebody had mentioned it to me, like, you know, how come nobody's ever done this? And I don't know. And I thought about it. I thought, boy, it'd be really great to read that.
Yeah.
But I just, nobody ever did it. I waited. And this was, we're talking 15 years ago.
Mm-hmm.
And I kept thinking about it. I'm like, wow, you know, I'd really, really like to read that. And then I found myself in a position where I could write it.
Yeah.
And so I, you know, really, it just, you know, did the, I knew the right people and yeah. so on and so forth and just moved it forward.
And then
somebody bought it.
And then getting all those people to talk, I mean, was there any, were some people harder to track down? I mean, you've got Bob Seger, Ted Nugent, Mitch Ryder in this.
The Seger,
Jack White is in this. I mean,
some people were, you didn't, you know, wouldn't talk. In fact, the Seger is the only secondhand material that I use.
Oh, really? Okay, just that was only quotes from some other.
One, that's one, and you'll see, yeah,
okay.
That's from a Cream magazine article. But no, most people were, I mean, they were fairly easy.
Yeah.
I mean, it wasn't that difficult to get them. They wanted to, you know,
right.
Be part of it. And I tried to go with the, I wanted, you know, the names, of course, because of the moves. But I really was, I cared a lot about the sound men and the people, that, mm-hmm. you know, the promoters and things like that. To me, that was just as important.
Yeah.
Stage hands, whatever. You know? So you try to get just the regular folks in there, too.
Yeah, because I think when people think about Detroit Rock and Roll, I think people think MC5 and the Stooges. Those are the two big names
sure.
that come up as far as, you know, because Seger and Nugent have a lot of baggage sort of with them, I think. You know, some people think that that's not, well, especially, you know, Nugent really gets slammed right and left in this book, which was,
yeah,
I don't know if it was surprising because what people think of Nugent. But yeah, I thought people maybe that knew him before he was what he is now would have nice things to say about him, but they really didn't.
People just don't seem to like
him.
Yeah,
he really, you know,
nobody seemed to like that guy, or they still don't. But he's still, you know, an interesting person, and he was one of the first guys to come to the table to do an interview.
Oh, was he really?
Yeah, I'd interviewed him before.
Well, I'm listening. I was gonna play some news for you.
All right.
We'll get to that. But yeah, because he, you know, I mean, his stuff, he had basically one hit, right, with the Amboy Dukes, and then it was... But his thing was everyone was doing drugs, okay?
Except for him.
Except for Ted.
Yeah.
And he still maintains that to this day.
Yeah.
That, you know, I was not...
Yeah, and...
I was not on anything.
Who knows?
Everyone at the Grandy Ballroom was dropping acid.
Except
Ted.
Yeah.
Yeah, this is Journey to the Center of the Mind, which was the Amboy Dukes hit. And I think this is a great record just of its time, regardless of who it is, you know?
It's a tremendous single.
Yeah, I mean
it's and it's cute from Rawhide.
Oh, is that what it is?
Rawhide theme.
Oh, doing. Yeah, it's good. It's great. I love it.
Yeah.
And, but yeah, he comes off, you know, as really like a, was he just full of himself back then? I mean, like,
I think
know
he's
he
full
is.
Of, he's full of himself now, too.
Now he is.
You know, but again, it's kind of a refreshing character.
Yeah.
Because he is what he is.
He is, yeah.
He's very unapologetic.
And then the MC5, of course, the originators of the scene, was that what you, I mean, how, what were they, because it seems like that's where the narrative really starts is with them.
It is, it's true. I mean, they were the first to really make a big, you know, just, you know, to be this, you know.
Yeah.
There you go.
Yeah.
And they were the first to really, really make a big dent.
Yeah.
In what was, you know, what's going to be this aggro music that would typify Detroit.
Yeah. But they, now when we read about MC5, it's very sad because, you know, a lot of those guys went to jail and just all kinds of, the drugs, I mean, with them, the drugs, maybe more than anybody else in the book, the drugs really seemed to be what they existed on and was really the reason why maybe Seger and Nugent went on to do what they were going to do and the MC5 did.
I think that's right.
Yeah.
I mean, you know, I mean, but at the same time, what would the MC5 have looked like, you know, six albums in?
Yeah.
Would they have been as important?
Right.
And I think you always got to look at music like that as a time and place thing.
Yeah.
You know, I mean, we take the first, those three Stooges albums, those first one, Funhouse and Raw Power. They tried to do that again, you know, decades later.
Yeah.
And they couldn't even come close
because it's the time and place in which
exactly.
it exists.
Yeah, yeah.
Because
and the recording equipment, everything.
But to me, when I hear like the Stooges, like if I hear this versus what we're just listening to, Kick Out the Jams, you know,
same song.
Well, but to me, this sounds catchier, more modern, more palatable to me. And it was the five just too
same year, a year later.
Okay, yeah, but that's what I mean. Like, were the five just too dirgy, not, I mean, because they never really went national. I mean, that's sort of the difference, I guess, when you read the book. The Stooges became this phenomenon, and while the people knew of the MC5, they never sold in numbers, they never...
No, but neither of them did.
Okay.
At the time,
okay.
Remember, you could buy any either of the MC5 albums later on. MC5 and Stooges
yeah.
went to Cutout.
Okay.
So you were picking them up for a buck.
Okay.
Neither of them were really recognized
yeah.
as being what they were
okay.
at the time.
Because I just hear this and I go, okay, this I hear bands trying to do this now.
Yeah.
But I don't really hear the MC5, people still trying to do the MC5 now. Like, there was something about it that was just a little...
It was a little harder to do.
A little, yeah, it was a little rougher
yeah.
and a little bit less refined.
I think the songs are actually more ambitious, probably. For
yeah.
Five. I think they were, musically, they were probably more... They had two guitars, and that was driving that, you know. But you see, I see great similarities between both the bands, you know,
yeah.
the attitude and so on, and... you couldn't go wrong spending a whole night listening to both bands.
Yeah. Well, when you see Iggy and the one story, the Cincinnati Pop Festival,
yeah.
which I went and found that on YouTube while
yeah.
I was reading the book, you
yeah.
got to watch that. If you've never seen that,
it's always
it's,
yeah.
it's amazing. And
it
the,
really
the peanut
is.
Butter, and he's standing up on this, it, the crowd, and just so iconic.
And it was funny when I was doing the book, it was things, I mean, I knew all about the Crosley Field
yeah.
concert. I remember they had, you know, they had Traffic, they had Alice Cooper, they had all these, Grand Funk played it. But I never knew the story when I was doing the research about Iggy coming off the stage and he still had the peanut butter on his hands, and he found this radio guy and he wiped his hands on this guy's white, nice white suit.
Well, it,
I didn't know about that.
And
I
what's weird, and I, there must be more of that footage that's out there. I just watched, it was like 7 or 8 minutes of the Stooges
yeah.
thing, and it seemed like it was edited from, you know, the
yeah,
TV broadcast.
Was, yeah.
But there's like this announcer who looks like he's like, I don't know who he was, I'm sure somebody will, but he looks like he's like the anchor at the news station.
Yeah, he was some straight guy.
In
yeah.
the booth,
yeah.
and then there's a guy that, I don't know who the other guy was. Was he one of the promoters or somebody?
I think so,
that's
yeah.
in there
yeah.
with him.
Yeah.
And he's like, here's the Stooges with TVI. And it's like the squarest guy. And it's
right.
like, it's this weird, like they were covering it because they just had to, because it was so big you couldn't not cover it.
Right.
But it was just
yeah.
the wrong guy to be hosting, like, a rock festival on television
in the book,
in 1970.
Yeah, in the book I do talk to the people around the production
yeah.
putting this on. Remember, this is on, you know, TV. Like,
right, but
was,
like UHF TV. I mean, there was no cable. This
right.
was, you know,
yeah. Yeah, and
in... Was it live or was it taped?
I think it was. They had a delay. I think they had delay at the
yeah.
time. But you know, you couldn't do much with back then.
Yeah.
But yeah, I don't know. Just the idea of sitting around and watching rock and roll like that at your home.
Right. I mean, imagine you're a kid and you
man.
See this.
Oh, it'd be bigger than Ed Sullivan.
Amazing, yeah.
Bigger
because
than
you see
the
fans going crazy and they're touching Iggy, and Iggy's smacking them and he's diving in there.
You know, I never thought about that, but you know, that would have the same effect, the Ed Sullivan effect on a
yeah.
kid.
Right.
I'm sure if I would have seen it, I would have, you know, that would have been
right. And we're a year after Woodstock then, 1970.
Yeah.
So it would have
yeah.
been, you know, and the Woodstock movie wouldn't have even come out at that point.
No,
so people
no.
hadn't really seen what went down at Woodstock.
Yeah.
And here you are seeing live, like,
Alex
this baseball Burton. Field.
Yeah, yeah.
Of, and in the book it talks about, because, you know, when the Beatles played Shea Stadium and they did all these other ballparks,
right.
you know, they were at second base.
Yeah, yeah.
And nobody was on the field. It was, they were in the stands, which means they're, God, 100 yards. The nearest person would have been
right,
to
yeah.
the Beatles. I mean, more than that. I don't know how far the between the bases plus.
You
had
yeah.
to go over to the clubhouses. And I guess at the Cincinnati show, that was the plan. And then the kids said, fuck it. And they just jumped
they
over
just said,
and
the, yeah.
rushed the field.
I mean, look at the bands that are playing. I mean,
yeah.
it's not like their fans are going to be like, oh, yeah, rules. That's a good idea. <You know?
laughs> But it also just seems like, oh, what a dumb idea. I mean, in a sense, a great event, and yet still a dumb idea to sort of try to make this event happen here.
Yeah,
you
yeah.
know.
Well, you've been to those shows at the stadium. You've been over to Comerica, right?
Yeah, so, yeah, yeah. I saw McCartney at Comerica.
They sit on the field
yeah,
now, right?
Yeah,
okay.
They do. And when I saw Springsteen at Wrigley in Chicago a few years ago.
Okay, same thing.
And, you know, yeah, a lot of people. I was in the stands. I would have been, yeah. like, where I was the fourth row of the stands behind third base, or actually behind the visiting dugout. So I would have been where the first fans would have been, although Bruce was really in center field and not at second base. But, yeah, and then there's standing people in the field and the whole thing, and, you know. Completely, you know, now we've come around to it and we can pull it off.
Right.
But back then, it just looks like anarchy when you see this Cincinnati Pop footage.
And they're thinking they got to play baseball in a couple days.
Yeah, exactly. You know? Oh, my God.
Yeah.
And then the other thing.
Yeah.
That same year, 1970, was the Goose Lake International Rock Festival. What was it called? I have it.
Man, that's an amazing thing.
Yeah, that was something I had never heard about before I read the book.
Oh, man.
And, yeah, the Goose Lake International Music Festival.
I've always known about Goose Lake. Yeah. And so, of course, you know, knowing that this was really, this was better than Woodstock. I mean, you think about who you had there and you know, everybody from the locals, the Stooges, and Mitch Ryder and so on.
Yeah, it's the who's who of Detroit, Michigan,
and
rock
and
roll.
The faces you had, you know, and so on.
Well, I have
so
the names here. Jethro Tull, Chicago, 10 years after the Flying Burrito Brothers. Mountain, John Sebastian, the James Gang with Joe Walsh. And then, you know, Bob Seger, MC5, Stooges.
Alice Cooper was supposed to play it, didn't show up.
Brownsville Station.
Brownsville Station. I mean, just an amazing line. I mean, what a lineup.
Yeah.
I mean, it's better than Woodstock.
Right, absolutely. In its way, you know, Woodstock, a lot of those bands that played Woodstock became famous just because they did Woodstock.
Right.
In a lot of ways. You know, it was just, it made people's careers to just be at Woodstock. But this Goose Lake, which was now, they planned it to be 60,000.
Yeah. And what, 200?
200, that's what they say here is 200 showed up. And the guy, what's the name of the guy who put this together?
Richard Songer?
Yeah, that's what they have here. Had a great plan.
It was a great
for festival, and I'm reading it going, they got to do shit like this now.
Yeah, it was a
explain to people what the innovations were at Goose Lake.
Well, the idea was, and this guy, this Richard Songer was a wealthy guy, and he built roads, so he had all this gear to build. Essentially what he did was built a community, and it was just a little town, and it had everything you'd possibly want. You know, it had all the refreshments, all the drugs, all the you know, enough bathrooms, and so on. And it was, when you look at the pictures of the site, you look at the map, and it's just, it's beautifully laid out.
Yeah.
And it was, some of it was paved really nicely.
Yeah, they said
done.
He had paved parking for 30,000 cars or something,
which
like
is
that,
really really good.
Yeah.
And so, you know, so he had set this up, and then they had a revolving stage. Mm-hmm. So what you would have is a band would be playing, they'd be done, and while they were playing, the next band would be setting up behind them on the revolving stage, and then you just flip the stage,
and
boom.
Like the music never stopped. It just was one band.
Yeah, because they found that they found that the real trouble was going on at these big festivals when bands stopped playing.
Okay.
And everybody got bored and started amusing themselves. Huh. So in this case, they tried this.
Yeah,
and
that's a good idea. You know, I see there are some festivals now where they'll have two stages set up in the same field.
Right. Yeah.
One stops, the next one starts.
Yeah.
And, you know, it's a good idea, I guess, you know.
It was really, really a good idea.
You miss stuff when you do that.
And most people said this is a Goose Lake was a big success.
Yeah.
I mean, people got really high and people had a lot of fun, you know? I mean,
So 200,000 people showed up. And the governor, and this was really interesting to me in the book because this relates a lot to the gathering, and we see this happens all the time, and I know from behind the scenes and even stuff that makes the press, the governor said we won't arrest people for pot on the site, or they made some deal. You know, the kids could get away with it or they could bring it in, but then the cops kind of double crossed them and they arrested them on the way out.
That's right.
That's right.
They started setting up outside, and so people would be going out, and there you'd be pinched, and a cop can think of any reason to pull you over, and they'd find pot,
Because at the gathering, you know, I don't know that we ever have this deal that bring pot in and you can do what you want. You know, in Cave and Rock, Illinois, it was private property.
Right.
And so once you got on the grounds, you could do whatever you want.
Yeah, but there is, even now in Ohio, there's the cops are on site.
The cops are on site.
But
they say,
well, I'm not going to bust it.
They look the other way.
Pot is the one thing they're not going to worry about. Yeah.
Well, they arrested
The guy with the Molly,
was that your, I don't know if it was that article that I read in it, but they must have made a big deal out of that.
It was like ridiculous though. The girl was naked and she had like Molly
$10.
$10, yeah.
Yeah, around her tits.
Yeah, and then they busted
completely
her.
Topless.
Right, and then they busted her boyfriend. I mean, it's like a gimme, yeah, like okay, I'll buy some.
Right, yeah.
Okay, you're under arrest.
Not That's the smartest so drug dealers this year.
No.
But I saw a lot of and then Goose Lake after that first one in 70, and since they had built this, they said, okay, this will be, we'll do an annual event here, we can do other things.
That's what
and
they
never happened.
State legislature clamped down on these festivals after that, because that was just too much fun.
And really, festivals, you know, as a kid growing up, we didn't have them. You know, I grew up in the late 70s, 80s. I mean, there was things like the US Festival you'd hear about, and certainly there were things in Europe. But in America, I think because of Altamont and Woodstock and Goose Lake and things like this, they did not exist.
I think you're right. There was that period where there were more than one state legislature that would pass laws saying, you know, that were addressing these mass gatherings for music.
Yeah.
So for a long time, like starting about the late 70s until... Mm-hmm. Gosh, I suppose Lollapalooza.
Yeah.
Is the first time you really saw some sort of, you know, organized thing, actual big bands playing.
But Lollapalooza wasn't even like this because people didn't camp. It was,
no,
you know,
right.
We did it. You know, I went to the first one in 91.
It was a traveling road.
Yeah, and it was an all-day concert more than it was the festival. Like, because I was jonesing to go to these things.
Okay.
Because they were having them in Europe.
Right.
And in 92, when I was 19, I think, when I started planning this trip, I went over to Glastonbury in England, which is now this giant legendary thing. And it was just coming back. They had taken a few years off. It was the first year back. And that was like unbelievable, like to get there and see all those people and all that.
Yeah.
The way that thing is just set up and people camp there for a week. And
who played, do you remember?
The year I went? Yeah. Boy, I'd have to look up the actual lineup.
Yeah.
The big draw for me, and you're not going to know what this
here
is,
we go.
Was the big draw for me as a 19-year-old Joel was a band called Carter the Unstoppable Sex Machine. They were the big thing in England that year, big indie rock. They're a duo that played to a backing track, a lot of fast guitar. I could play a little Carter. Do you want
to
hear
some? Yes, I would like to hear some.
Let me play
got
Carter.
Got you all the way over to...
Well, you know, I don't have a Carter queued up. But then there was... boy, there was stuff like, you know, it was the big bands of the day you know, so you had Blur, you had bands like Lush, you had The Fall was there.
The Fall played.
Television did a set, and I wasn't a big Television guy because I was 19 and I didn't really give a shit.
Yeah.
But the Television, the Legendary, they were coming back or whatever.
Those bands you just mentioned are all like, I think they'd be worth going.
Yeah. Boy, and then just Tom Jones did a set in the middle of the afternoon. He did a surprise set.
Yeah.
So, yeah, there was a lot of just amazing stuff. And then you'd just see shit, you know, just the weird. Here's let me give you a Sheriff Fat Man. This is a little Carter the Unstoppable Sex Machine. Imagine 50,000 drunken 15-year-olds.
And where are they now?
Well, one of them sitting here.
Playing.
That's the other thing. I wasn't old enough to drink. And I got to go to England.
And you could drink.
And I could drink. And they were, you know, the big thing for me there was they would have, you could buy weed from a guy, you know, like a Jamaican guy. And then they had a tent where you could smoke it. So you would buy it and then you'd go in this tent and you'd smoke it. And you can imagine you're in a tent how completely stoned you'd get.
Wow.
Yeah. But this is Carter the Unstoppable Sex Machine. Here.
Okay.
So this would be punk rock with a little bit of synth, you know, kind of indie, you know, British indie. Take the jam, add a drum machine. You know, very British, though. A lot of British lyrics in this.
Okay.
But they were the headliners, and then on one of the nights, and I forget who the other headliners were, but there. And then there was, you know, things like The Orb, which was like the dance acts, the early sort of techno rave stuff. That was right then. You know, 92 was very early rave stuff. And there was a lot of that Primal Scream played at that. A lot of cool bands.
It's a really good lineup.
Morrissey canceled.
Yeah.
Oh, Morrissey was supposed to be there.
The lineup just got better.
And then the band James filled in for Morrissey, if you know who James was. Mm-hmm. They had a lot of big hits.
Yeah.
And then I remember Fishbone was on right before Carter.
Okay.
So Fishbone was doing Party at Ground Zero and all that shit, which is great, you know, ska music.
Okay. All right.
So, yeah, it was a cool festival. But anyway, I just, that was the thing that I wanted to have as a kid, is to have that festival experience, you know, a young man, teenager. And you really couldn't get it unless you went to Europe. And now, boy, there's a million of them, and the Gathering's just one of them.
You know, but, you know, of course, because of Live Nation. It's like a multi-billion dollar industry, and you know, you got all the corporate sponsors come on board.
Sure.
And so you got the, you know, the, it killed me when I was like reading about like how these special packages for people, like, so you never really, your feet never have to touch the ground when you go to these
things. Well, yeah, that's the thing. And that's, I get that that's a little corporate and stuff, and not a blast, but, you know, people, what the thing is, though, people have finally realized if we do these right, people can have a great time. They can have that experience, you know, because that's what they, when they talk about the Gathering, everyone says, you know, kids go and it's the greatest time of their life, and they have this sort of moment, that awakening or that coming of age moment at these things. And, you know, for me, I had that in Glastonbury in 92, and then I went to Reading in 94 back to England and stuff. So I, you know, it's one of those things that, you know, now people get that. People had it at Woodstock, people had it at Goose Lake, and a whole generation didn't get to have that thing.
Yeah, I suppose.
Now kids get it, you know.
But at the same time, during that time in that generation, we were all going to jamming into little tiny places.
Well, that's where we're going to get to that,
too.
They
held 100 people, and you get to see a band. You'd see the Ramones with, you know, 100 of your best friends.
Before we get to this, I want to get to Bookies, because Bookies is almost the star of your book, in a sense, I thought. But just staying in the 60s, how big was Grand Funk Railroad?
Grand Funk were huge.
And
I mean, but critics didn't like them.
Yeah, and I was going to say, and my next question is, why?
Well, because they were awesome.
Really?
Yeah.
I mean, I listen to this, and it's I mean,
okay,
it's,
now
it's
you're
corny.
Listening to, you're
it's
listening
corny
to later
a little
era.
Bit. Okay, so you're talking about the stuff
albums.
before they broke.
But, I mean, this is a good song, too.
It is a good song, but it's like,
I mean, it's been played to death.
It has.
It's really a pretty good song. I think it's powerful. I think it's got.
This is more an American band.
Yeah. I mean, but yeah, this is a little later era.
Because I did a casino gig once. This was up in Petoskey.
Yeah.
And I was playing the little comedy club. And in the big showroom was Mark Farner. This was like 5-6 years ago. And people left. And it was funny because in the front row, there was this couple. And I go, okay, you know, the gig was horrible. It was a horrible place. And I go, what brings you here? And they're like, well, we left the Mark Farner show.
That says a lot.
And I go, tell me he did wear an American band before he left, because otherwise I'm going to feel bad. That.
And, you know, he didn't even sing on this song.
Okay,
that's
this
Don
is the
Brewer, the drummer.
Good God.
But yeah.
So you're saying if you go see Mark Farner, he doesn't sing this?
I wholly doubt
it. He probably does.
I wholly doubt that.
He probably does.
I wholly doubt it. I don't even think he has that, you know. They had some sort of legal squabble, I think.
He's out. I looked them up, and but this is another, you know.
Okay, this is, you're playing the worst Grand Funk.
Wait a minute. When I go into Google Music and I tell me, give me Grand Funk Railroad.
Oh, Google Music.
Oh, no, I can do worse than this.
Oh, Lord,
Here. I can do worse. Okay, this might actually be slightly better.
I like
your
this.
Captain.
This is not bad. Yeah.
All right.
This is not bad. But no, you listen to those first. Now, you pull up the live album, that double live album that they recorded, and see, this is.
Okay. All right. See, my point is proven.
Your point is now it's telling me that Google Music doesn't know very good music.
Well, they base it on what people listen to when they want to hear Grand Funk. That you type it in, and that's what comes.
Sure,
Okay, I'm with you.
Yeah, but if you're into music and you know like Grand Funk, you know they did.
But they were also
really good stuff.
Resented by a lot of bands on that scene for just blowing up the way they did, right? I mean,
yeah, they were because they had this
impression
great,
that I got.
Great manager Derry Knight who elevated them. He took them all away. And he also ripped him off pretty grandly, but but yeah, I mean that's an old story.
Well, an old story for a lot of these bands.
Yeah, it
was
is.
The bands that had the best manager were the ones that made it, and that some bands, even though they were great bands, they just. You know, MC5 never had their shit together. It
no,
like.
They didn't have the management that would take them to that level. Yeah. And is that in the book? That's what Dennis Thompson said. He said we should have been Grand Funk.
Yeah,
and they would have been that aggro Grand Funk that you hear on that live album, the first couple albums.
One other in the 60s, and I don't know, they weren't from Detroit, but I know just from my own thing. But Tommy James and the Shondells, not because boy, when
I
you
talked
look
to Tommy James,
did you?
Yeah,
okay,
he's from Niles, Michigan.
Yeah, but when you look at their catalog, and they're not in the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame or anything,
I don't know,
they've got half a dozen giant songs.
Oh, they were huge,
and they're great songs,
really good.
And I wonder, like, why not them? Why were they not? You know, I mean, I know that they maybe they weren't the trend setting and they weren't from the city and, you know, they traveled, I think, more. They were more of a touring act.
Right, yeah.
They didn't have a home base where they had a home club or anything. But God damn it, when you listen to Tommy James, it's just...
Oh, I think Tommy James is fantastic.
There's some great stuff. And
did you ever read his... He wrote that great book.
No, I haven't read it.
Oh, my God. It's just about
the
mob.
If I play...
And, I mean, it's really good.
Let me see if I can pull up some Tommy James here. Because it's all stuff that all sounds different.
Yeah.
The songs all sound different, but yet they're all great, you know? And you just go... Man, how are these guys? You know, there's like a box set or something that I have.
With some of the psychedelic songs on it.
Yeah,
too.
I mean, let me just go. I mean, these are just the top four or five that come up here.
Are we doing Google Music again?
We are.
Oh, man. Like, just
but I mean, these are all things that, I mean, everybody who knows rock and roll knows these songs, and maybe you didn't realize these are Crimson and Clover.
Oh, sure. This is a great one.
I mean, amazing.
Yeah. Especially the extended version.
Okay, that's, I think, which we're not going to get to the extended part. I mean,
right.
Yeah, but I mean...
We just play that guitar thing.
But how great is that? And then here's the next one. I mean, this is a ballad. Crystal Blue Persuasion. Another amazing cut.
Yeah.
Doesn't even sound like...
He kept cranking them out.
Right.
You know, he was just like a machine.
This is one that I love that isn't... as big as some of the other ones, but Sweet Cherry Wine, you know this?
Yeah.
Yeah, great. It just keeps going here.
Hanky Panky.
I Think We're Alone Now.
Yeah. Lena Lovitch covered
it. Yeah.
Children Behave.
I mean, it just keeps going. I could just keep hitting these. Dragging the Line. And why these... I mean, this is all... I mean, I just played Grand Funk. They're Big Five songs. And here I'm playing the Big Five Tommy... I mean, I don't think Grand Funk Railroad's in the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame either, but... You know, but here's... I mean, come on. Okay. Come on. You can't do any more than what I just did. Should prove anybody. I mean, this is one of the great, you know...
Your point being Tommy James and the Shondells, or just Tommy James, just is terrific.
Terrific!
Yeah. And again, his book. He did a book. He did
a real
cool book.
I'll get into that.
And he talked about, he's like, he had some sort of, he signed it, he got a movie option for it and everything.
Really?
So, yeah, I don't know the movie.
When I read the book, I kind of went like, boy, maybe these guys, even in their day, were not as big as... You know, just because I think now, like, how are they not in the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame having all those hits? I mean, come on.
Yeah,
some legendary tunes. And the covers, I mean, just the covers of Crimson and Clover have been big.
Right, yeah.
The covers of Moni Moni have been big hits. I mean, Billy Idol's Moni Moni was huge.
Well, the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame is all about politics.
Well,
anyway. That's a whole different... It's certainly not based on merit.
No.
So, it has nothing to do with real music.
All right, tell me about Bookies. Bookies sounds like the greatest place in the world. Well, and God damn it, I wish... Now, there is a Bookies in Detroit now. I want to say Bookies is about as... Buffalo Wild Wings is about as edgy as the current Bookies.
Okay, so it's
I think I've been in the new Bookies once.
Okay.
Well, it's over by Comerica Park. It's on Cass.
Oh, God.
Sort of just behind the Fox there.
Okay.
But nothing like the original Bookies. Tell us about that.
Well, the original Bookies was this place where you walked in. The one thing I remember when I first got there is the black and white floor, the kind of a checkerboard floor, and then these big booths, huge, like kind of circular booths, and a great PA.
Yeah.
And the story was there was this guy, Frank Gagan, who owned it. It was a supper club. And a couple guys from the scene, from the people here in Detroit, and they were looking for some new music, and they wanted to do new music, and they went over to this guy's place, and they said, "Hey, man, you know, we'll put some bands in here." And they started, you know, it's an old story where you see a bar that's not being used all that much, and say a couple of enterprising people go, "Hey, look, we'll put some music in here, bring some people in," and it worked.
And it was like a gay bar, right?
Or it was
something?
It was, yeah. Because
it was on Six Mile, which is now, like, because when I was reading about it, Menjo's was around the corner. And I go, I've been past Menjo's.
Yeah.
I know where that is. And then when you look it up, it's a parking lot now, I think, old Bookies stood.
Bookies is like a party store now.
Is it? Okay, yeah, because there's a party store right there. That's what it is?
Yeah, kind of that site. They used to have this big parking lot next to Bookies. And it was where you could kind of almost park safely. and then they had a guard out there once in a while.
Yeah.
Who I think they'd also sold drugs. But it was, you know, it was just, it was a great place because you got all these bands. Yeah, that was the main thing, because you had this scene, Detroit scene.
Yeah.
But then the guy that was booking at Vince Bannon started bringing all these national acts. And, of course, the Police.
The Police, yeah. That's the famous thing that they had them.
Yeah.
Nobody, it's in the book that they had 40 people for the first time the Police went through. And then, I don't know if it was Roxanne broke or something broke.
Yeah.
And they came back and it was insane. Yeah.
Yeah,
that's great. Because they would have been the CBGBs, right, of Detroit?
Totally.
That
totally
would have been right where all of those bands went to.
It's totally
new
correct.
Wave, punk, right in that era.
Unfortunately, though, I mean, Detroit's scene at that time, the bands couldn't, the bands weren't that great.
Or the Detroit bands.
Yeah, the Detroit bands weren't great. Right. And so they were bringing in these out-of-town bands. Yeah. That were really, I mean, I saw the Dead Boys there. So
okay.
Perry Ubu there, Magazine there.
Because I think that's another thing that Detroit, and we'll get to this, you know, my era, which would have been like the early 90s, that grunge alternative, that's how old I am.
Yeah.
Detroit music was pretty terrible then, too.
It really was.
But we had all the national acts, and they came through, and then we had a blast watching them.
Because of St. Andrews.
Yeah, St. Andrews. And that was the same guy, right? The guy that got to start bookies, ended up doing Clutch Cargo.
They started moving
and
it
then
over.
And then St. Andrews.
A partner of his took it over and that kind of thing. Yeah,
good.
But it was the same kind of connected people that were doing really great things. I mean, these are, again, this is pre-Live Nation, so you're getting, everything's better.
Yeah, it was just local corporate. Guys who would say...
Yeah, it's not as corporate, the prices are a little lower, and so on, and it's just, it's more reasonable.
Right, because that's the story you hear, and I don't know how much it exists, and I know, you know, being of that age, this would happen with us occasionally, but, you know, it would be, you know, a phone call, or bands would come to town, and then they'd be sleeping on your floor, and then everyone was hanging out and partying.
Well, there was the Greystone, where all kinds of great bands, Einstürzer and Neubauten played, and, of course, Black Flag would always play there.
That was the hardcore venue on Michigan Avenue.
It was an alternative music venue, and that was, you know, same thing. Corey Russ booked it, and he'd put you in there, and then go upstairs, you'd crash out.
Yeah, because that's a little bit before my time as well, that venue.
Okay.
Because when I got started going to bands, St. Andrews was the place.
Okay.
And then you had the big venue, because the State Theater wasn't refurbed, was the Latin Quarter on Grand Boulevard.
In
Wood, just off Woodward there.
Yeah, yeah.
A couple blocks. And they only had shows there for about 3 years when I was going to them.
Okay.
But they had, I mean, that was where you'd have 3,000 people in there. You know, Nine Inch Nails on their first record, the Pixies. Jesus and Mary Chain was there, a lot of stuff.
And that was a real challenge in the book to kind of write around that era, because there was truly, very clearly nothing
happening in Detroit. Yeah, that's the thing, because the local bands were, and I was doing lights, you know, I used to do lights for a local band.
Okay, what band?
I did a band called Touch Freak.
Okay.
And Touch Freak was my buddy Mike and Pat from high school, and a couple guys they met at U of D. And they played all the venues. They played the Ritz, they played the Shelter, St. Andrews, and they won the 89X Battle of the Bands in 92 or something.
Okay.
And they did a demo. They won a session at the Temper Mill or one of those studios, and did a 6-track thing. And broke up right after that. But for a few years, man.
You know, that was also an era, like, all over the country, there were bands. Your whole goal, it used to be your whole goal in putting a band together was playing some good music.
Yeah.
And, you know, get drunk and get laid.
Yeah.
But then later on, it became, you put together a band and let's make some money.
Yeah,
Let's see if we can't get some corporate entity to think we're good and pay us a bunch of money.
Yeah, that's sort of where it got, because all those bands were, all those bands, you know, that were breaking, they were, you know, Touch Freak, when I was working for them, they was like, well, they're Jane's Addiction, they're Faith No More, they're a little bit of this, you know, whatever was big, you know, Smashing Pumpkins, okay, they kind of sound like that. Maybe a little Pearl Jam, the vocalist was sort of compared to them. And so they were trying, you know, and then there were guys sniffing around. There was managers sniffing around. And the whole thing just fell apart once they had any success. Like, that was just it.
It's all about doing music for the wrong reasons. Yeah. I mean, you're doing it because you want to make something, some good art. But instead, it's more to appeal to.
Yeah. Now, I liked, when I was listening to these bands, I thought the Romantics were pretty good.
Yeah.
And people know Talking in Your Sleep, and they know What I Like About You, but I listened to some of the other stuff. I enjoyed it.
Yes.
You know, I thought it was pretty good, and I go, here, okay, these guys never really made it beyond the two hits, though, right?
No, not really. I mean,
they get ripped off, too. I mean, that's in the book.
Yeah, they got ripped off real bad. The book chronicles how they also got taken, but... But they, you know, they always did. They had a pretty good sound. I mean,
yeah,
could,
I mean,
it's,
this,
it's easy to write them off, but they came out of that bookies
sure
scene.
But this is, you know, when I hear the garage rock stuff from the early 2000s, the Hives or something, not necessarily even the Detroit guys.
Yeah,
this is it right here. I mean, this is the Hives. If you wanted, you know,
yeah,
any of those groups. I like this. Johnny Thunder spent a lot of time in Detroit. I wasn't aware of that.
Yeah, yeah.
And
he was around, like, all the time.
Yeah.
And you'd see him in the middle of the summer walking down the street, like, in Ann Arbor, and he'd have, like, a flannel shirt. Like, shirt on.
There's just no stories about him where he's not incapacitated.
He lived his life incapacitated.
Yeah, it's too bad. Because I'm not even a big, like, Johnny Thunders guy, but, you know, the Replacements were into them, and they were a huge band to me.
Okay.
And they, you know, they wrote a song called Johnny's Gonna Die, which is about Johnny Thunders
right
while he's still alive,
yeah,
you know.
Yeah.
But then you hear this, and you go, okay, I get this. You know, I go, this sounds good to me.
Yeah.
I get why people like, because you hear these stories, and you're like, who would like this fucking guy? He's a mess.
Oh, the Heartbreakers played at Bookies in June 79, and that was one of the best shows to this day that I've ever seen.
Yeah, that's Chinese Rock. That's a good song.
Yeah.
And you hear a lot of the influence.
It's all that New York.
Yeah.
It's all that New York punk stuff. Yeah. Like, you know, just remembering, like, Richard Hell was on it and Dee Dee Ramone.
And then when we get to, like, what I knew, which was, you know, for me, the book went much faster when I started to know the people you were interviewing.
I wondered about this because, I tried to include all these eras. Some of the idea was to get people to read, say you're an old-timer,
mm-hmm,
and you read, I want you to read about the newer stuff, the stuff that came along, you know,
uh-huh,
like with the White Stripes and all that.
Yeah.
And then for someone like you, maybe, you can go back and read the stuff about Goose Lake and
sure,
like
I didn't know any of that stuff.
And then it gets to your era.
But then
it gets
to, you know, Troy Gregory, I know a little bit, and some of
there
these guys, the Sights, I knew a little bit, some of those guys.
Yeah.
You know, when you're reading about all these guys, you know, one thing I've noticed is that my generation, the 90s, and these guys were a little bit later, that, you know, those guys had as many flameouts, you know, because I remember the 90s coming up and, you know, grunge and alternative got rid of the hair bands. Well, those hair bands were all drunk and they were wasted. And, you know, the guys from the 60s, they were just killing themselves with drugs. And you get to the 90s guys. And after a decade of that, you just go, well, how many corpses do we have? How many flameouts do we have? It really wasn't any different.
Yeah.
As much as people had this attitude of like, oh, we're going to do it right and all that excess, we're going to get rid of the excess and be pure and be about the music, and it really wasn't.
Well, what I noticed is that you're right, though, about getting back to the music. This is, again, that what we, mm-hmm, I guess people call about the garage era.
Yeah.
Again, you had people doing music for the right reason.
Yeah.
They were just playing it because they loved it.
Yeah.
They knew. They didn't have any like illusions they were going to have some big contract or anything. And that's just great. That's when the music got really, really good again. And of course, rock and roll is excessive, so you're going to have a few casualties.
You're going to. And then, of course, I can't not ask you about this. White Stripes. I mean, when you talk about Detroit rock and roll, the modern biggest thing, you know, you could argue they're the biggest thing that ever came out of Detroit rock and roll wise. Just
you could say it's up there with Seeger and Nugent.
There,
I mean,
sure,
although
yeah,
not artistically, but,
not,
yeah,
but you know, for
it's better
for its thing. I mean,
yeah,
when people talk about Detroit, identified with Detroit as much as the MC5
yeah,
Stooges
yeah,
at this point.
Yeah,
and Jack and you know, Jack does not come off. I know Jack talked to you in the book, but he doesn't come off well, I don't think, in the book or just in general. And I know you like the guy, because I know we've talked about him before.
Yeah,
we're driving around.
Truly.
What is with him? Because, you know, he was in the Go, and then he had to quit the Go because he didn't want to be the contract.
Yeah.
And then there was the whole Jason Stolzheimer thing, which we can get into. But what is it with this guy? And he just had a thing. He's beating up the Black... He's threatening the guy from the Black Keys at a bar a couple weeks ago. What?
I don't know anything.
What is with this guy?
Yeah, I do. I just don't know. I don't know if he's got some sort of anger issue or...
But,
or
I mean, it just seems
know,
like...
I mean, he was... I'll tell you, out of all the interviews I did in the book, the time I spent with him was the most pleasant.
Okay.
It really was.
Because, you know, I've seen these things, and I saw that movie, you know, It Might Get Loud, where him and The Edge and Jimmy Page
really
get together.
Good.
It was a great movie.
Really good.
And you hear Jack talk, and you go, oh, man, this guy knows what he's doing. This guy's
he truly
entertaining,
truly.
Seems to love the music.
And I always say, you know what, it predisposes me to appreciate him. Is he's got all this money, and look what he's doing. He's doing Third Man.
Yeah.
I mean, he's not making money out of a lot of that stuff. He's putting out really good music for the right reasons.
Yeah, and you know?
I mean, here's a guy doing a Wolf Eyes album. He's doing Timmy's Organism album. I mean, that's, I don't know. And
do you
to
want
me, again, I can strip out a lot of people's, you know, say, well, I don't like the guy for this or that. But just try to look past that okay. and see what the guy's doing.
I have a Wolf Eye story, but before that, I know, which people don't even know fucking what. I was surprised
all
Wolf
ears.
Eyes was in the book because.
Yeah,
okay,
because
but let me ask you about Jack White while we're talking about Jack
yeah,
White.
Sure.
Jason Stolzheimer from the Von Bondies, okay?
Okay.
Now, granted, their thing was a little incestuous in a sense because Jack was dating Marcy, who was in Von
mm-hmm,
Bondies.
Mm-hmm.
They were touring together, Jack and Meg, his ex wife. And then Marcy's there, and they're all hanging out. This is the Von Bondies, by the way. Good song, too. Come on, come on. It's probably the one anyone knows from them. But and then there's this fight at the Magic Stick. Or there's, according to Jason, he was sucker punched.
Okay.
Other people that were there said it was a fight.
Yep.
Marcy's in the book and says, I was trying to peel Jack off. Jason told him not to do it. What happened? Because even the book doesn't clarify.
No, there's no way to clarify. You know, it's just like anything when you see it, when there's a you have different people witnessing an event.
Yeah.
You're always, you know, five people are going to have five different stories.
Yeah, for those who don't know the story, according to Jason Stolzheimer, he was assaulted by Jack White, had his eye, I mean, if you see the photos of him, I'm sure you can find them online. His eye is completely swollen.
Yep.
Didn't know this, but in the book, Jason says, you know, they had their big media day. They were launching
right.
this album. All the media, the record company said, you can't do media looking like that. They canceled all of their stuff. The album ultimately didn't do what they thought it was going to do.
Yeah.
Jason thinks it was because they couldn't
do media.
He felt
it was timed.
Yeah.
It was timed to that, of course. I don't know about that.
So could have been Jack's motivation then? Is he said, they're going to launch this record and I'm going to fuck them up before? Or was there,
I pretty much
was there a personal thing with Marcy? Was there a
I think they just had differences between
yeah.
those two guys.
And
I mean,
didn't Jack produce this record as well?
I think so. And I think what they said, you know, what a lot of people have said to me, it was a bar fight.
Yeah. Well, you know? And that's in the book, too. And I go, I don't know. I'm still, like, confused because that was, when that happened, I remember it was a big deal amongst my friends and everyone was going, oh, yeah, I was there and I saw this. And I was like, and then people, oh, I know Jack and he's an asshole and why would he do that? And Jason's a good guy. And then other people, I don't know.
You know, you always, anytime you got a dispute like that, you've got all kinds of different. Since I didn't know either of the characters, I don't, you know, really can't say. But it's a bar fight.
Yeah.
And so there was a lot of ugliness and a lot of bad feelings for Jack White here in Detroit.
And, you know, Jack had all that success, and God bless him, and he deserved it because the music's great. I mean, I love, especially the first, like, three White Stripes albums. Love them. Great.
The hard work, there was a way I could kind of see in the hard work that he did and so on. So,
and I went to all those shows back in the day with the Stripes. And in fact, if you look over to your left, you see there's an NME article up there on my board there, NME.com.
Yeah.
And that was the Strokes in 2002 were the big hit, them and the Stripes, and they did a series of shows together. Where they did two in Detroit, they did Clutch Cargos, and they did Shane Park, where the Strokes opened for the Stripes. Then they went to New York, and they played, I forget, some club, and then they played Radio City, where the Stripes opened for the Strokes. Well, the first night in Clutch Cargos, I wrote a report that ended up on NME, and that's it right there.
That's
so
your
I
clip.
Was there.
That's your
My
clip.
Name is in that article, if you flip through that article. It's
all right. Is it favorable?
Oh, no. I was talking about the Strokes mostly, but I reviewed the whole show.
Okay.
And the Strokes debuted a new song that night and all kinds of stuff, and that was there. So I was there for that.
Did they pay? It's documented. Did they pay for that?
No.
They didn't pay?
I submitted it to their thing.
Damn.
But you know, it made that was the online, but it did make a condensed version made the print paper as well,
wow.
Which was cool because I was a big NME was something I read.
Oh sure,
I mean that's how I knew to even go to Glastonbury Festival in Reading.
Yeah,
I would go to the record store and I'd get NME,
and it
was 3-4 weeks old. So a lot of times, you know, you try to get these tickets,
right?
You'd have to call 01 whatever the country code and all that to try to book some of these tickets is crazy. But okay, here's my Wolf Eyes story because I know you're all here.
Oh yeah,
explain who Wolf Eyes is. You go ahead and then I'll tell my story.
Well, Wolf Eyes is this terrific band from, you know, the Detroit area around actually just parts of Michigan. Play a particularly fiery brand of noise.
Yeah.
And it's just really, I mean, it could go from anything from cohesive song structures to completely broken down parts of instruments being clanged on.
Yeah. I went to a show, and I'm trying to remember who the headliner was that I wanted to see. It might have been the Yeah, Yeah, Yeah. So we're talking right around 2001, 2002, 2003, maybe. Okay. is at the Majestic Theater. Yeah, big venue in Detroit for people who don't know. I don't know, 1,000 people, 1,200 people maybe. Yeah. But good sized, you know, touring bands would come there. So it could have been the Yeah Yeah Yeahs. It could have been the Hives or something. But I think it might have been Yeah Yeah Yeahs. Anyway, so I'm in there. And Wolf Eyes is the opener. And I'm right on the rail. Okay. I don't fucking know who Wolf Eyes is. I don't know. I never heard of the Wolf Eyes. I could give a shit, right? I'm right on the rail. These fucking guys would not shut up. This thing went on. And I'm not a guy, you know, look, nowadays, if I didn't care about the headline, you know, nowadays, if that's happening, I walk in, I'll go to the back by the bar, I'll have a drink, I'll hang out. But I wanted my good spot for the headliner. I wanted to be there. And I swear to God, I could not fucking take it anymore. And you know how it is. And whether you like them or not, you can imagine if somebody wasn't a fan, knowing what Wolf Eyes sounds like.
Yeah.
And I could play Wolf Eyes here, probably. I could go on my Google Music and get Wolf Eyes.
That's a good idea.
I want people to continue listening to this show, so I'm not going to do that. I don't want people to turn this show off. Yeah, there you go. Do it. Start screaming or whatever. Maybe I can make a feedback loop. It'll be exactly Wolf Eyes. I'll do it right here on the board. No. And I just started screaming about how fucking bad they sucked.
I bet they never
and
heard
I
that
may,
before.
Not, well, and here's the thing. One of their, and I don't know who it was, but one of their guys or somebody was, you know, they were taping the show. And these guys come over, at least one guy, and I kind of remember two guys with video cameras. And the video cameras went from the band to me. And when I saw the camera, I said, I have no problem doing, you know, in my mind, I went, I'm fine. You, and I looked right in the camera and said, Wolf Eyes fucking sucks. Get the fuck off the fucking stage. I mean, just a string of obscenities. I might have been a little bit drunk as well.
You're that guy.
And I went off on them, and I was just like, there it is. It's on. It's documented. So maybe there's, I don't know, you know the Wolf Eyes guys.
Hopefully it shows up somewhere on
the
video.
There may be. Well, that's what I don't know. I mean,
very angry, angry guy.
A young Joel Fregimenti.
That's right.
Angry about Wolf Eyes and screamed directly into their cameraman's. And it was their guys. It wasn't just a guy who was just there. It was they were doing it. And I let them have it as best I could. But, you know, they seemed to, I mean, the cameraman anyway, seemed to relish.
Of course.
In the. Oh, God. Because, you know, you want a reaction anyway.
Well,
I mean,
yeah.
No one's there to see Wolf Eyes. They're there to see. And that was the thing, too. No one really gave a fuck about them. But people are there for the headliner, whoever that happened to be. And I was just pissed. And just fucking let them have it.
Well, you know, I've seen them a couple times. And one time, I didn't think they were all that good. The second time, I thought they were really awesome.
Well, I don't know. I don't know that I ever want to.
New single is really good.
I don't know that I ever want to see Wolf Eyes again.
I'm just telling you. You can play that.
If somebody has the video, if somebody has a Wolf Eye, if somebody has the video of me, they can. I will have. If here's the thing, Wolf Eyes, if you're listening, Steve, you can get a hold of them. If they have the video of me heckling Wolf Eyes, I will have Wolf Eyes on the show. They can play. I'll set them up here in the Joel Radio Studios, and they can do a live performance on the podcast if they have the video.
All they've got to do is produce
it. If they can produce the video
of me, you. A young you.
15 or whatever, 13 years ago, heckling Wolf Eyes at the Majestic. If that video exists and they can produce it and we can put it on the show, they're welcome to come in here. I'll give them a whole show. How's that sound? Is that a square deal?
That would be an awesome show.
There we go. Well, I would love to see. I would just love to see the tape.
This is it's all you want to do.
It's all
really.
I want to do. See them, and I will let them promote, play whatever they want.
Small,
there you
it's
go.
It's quite a grand gesture.
You can make that happen.
Let
you
me
can
see.
Be the
let
go
me
between.
See. Let all me right. see.
A couple be things, because you know, of course, how we met. You know, and when people talk about this, and that's why you know, I think more than anything, with you, and one of the reasons I liked you so much is when you came to the gathering and saw and asked me questions about, you know, what was going on and the whole thing. And I thought, here's a guy who actually gets it. That's the thing about you that I got. There's a little chicken hunting for you. Little, maybe the biggest tune of all time here.
Yeah, this is probably this.
And one of the things that's great about Detroit Rock City is, you know, the people that, you know, because Detroit, I should mention, Detroit Rock City is an oral history.
Yeah.
Meaning that it's the stories that people tell. Obviously, you edit those and make the narrative there.
Yeah.
Which is very effective when in a rock and roll book, because I read the Seattle one, Everybody Loves Our Town, about Seattle.
They did the same
similar,
thing in that. Yeah.
Really good
same,
book as
same
well.
Approach, yes.
But the people that talk about ICP say, you know, not the brightest guys, but boy, they were driven and they were determined to get this done. And And of course, Mikey Clark, you know, who you can't, because his quotes in the book are great, because he goes, you know, people were, and I think, does he say when he first met them, he goes, well, this sucks, but they've always got money, or something to the effect of.
Something like that, yeah.
I know this isn't good.
He didn't like it.
They keep bringing me money,
right?
And some of these other bands don't have it.
And they really liked him. That was the thing. Yeah. He was so fast. They liked Mike.
And when you hear stuff, and Chicken Hutton is an early thing, but boy, just listen to some of this stuff. When I talk about ICP, I really... I don't want to belittle, obviously, Violent J, Shaggy 2 Dope, but to me, Mike Clark is the star of that band, at least on the records that he did. I mean, it's outstanding, the stuff that he did for them.
Well, you know, the first time I heard them, the first thing I heard was Malenko.
Okay.
And I remember listening to it. I was at a friend's house and reading the fold-up, and I'm looking, I'm going, these songs are amazing.
Yeah.
And through reading the credits, I realized that Clark was writing the songs,
yeah,
and those guys were writing the, you know.
Yeah.
And I said, this is just a great collaborative effort.
Yeah.
I knew Clark was kind of the guy doing the beats.
Right. And
so on.
And I like the ICP stuff without Mike, some of it.
Oh, yeah.
But boy, when you hear him, man, he really is.
That's a force.
He's a genius.
Right.
I mean,
you're
he
right.
really is, you know. And maybe it's because now they're using some younger guys over there.
Yeah.
Maybe it's just because Clark and I are kind of the same age, and we listen to the same stuff coming up, and he came up in rock circles and I did. But boy, his stuff, man. I mean, just listen. I mean, even if you don't.
Yeah.
It's as good as, you know, I mean, it's just good music, you know, if it was.
And that's the thing I still can't understand is, like, when I, you know, people kept going, well, they suck.
Yeah.
There's some reason there's a disco. I don't understand why everybody hates them.
Yeah.
I just do not. There's no matter what happens. And I've run into so many people.
Right.
Said, oh, you're doing, you know, everybody was my friend during Detroit Rock City. Oh, yeah, it's great. Yeah, rock on. And what's your next book? Juggalo. And they're like, oh, good luck with that. I've had people I told that, you know, in a
yeah.
And they just, I've never heard from them again.
Yeah, well, that's...
which is fine. That's.
But I think if you just listen to the music and you take away the look, or you take away the Juggalos as fans, it just becomes... I mean, you're going to listen to Eminem or something and enjoy that.
Yeah.
This sounds as good to me as that. I mean, or any of that stuff. I mean,
Better. And then
when you go to the gathering and you see all of this who's who of hip-hop,
yeah,
you know, going back the 80s guys and even the current guys, and you see ICP's live show, it's a fucking amazing hip-hop show.
Again,
I mean,
I still don't get it. And I'm not even a hip-hop guy.
Right.
So,
right, and I'm not either.
People hate them so much.
Yeah,
I don't get it either.
But I mean, I could play you these Mikey Clark produced tracks.
Oh yeah,
all day, and they're all catchy, and they're great, and just amazing. And then that's not to, like I said, not to belittle Violent J and Shaggy, because those guys add.
It's not going on without them.
No, it's not going on without them. But boy, just to have Mike doing that for him is.
Yeah.
Yeah,
well, Mike's just really, really good. You've heard the stuff he's done with, you know, with other people. I mean,
well,
he wrote Kid Rock all summer long.
Yeah, his biggest hit.
Yeah,
ever.
How he looped up just that piano
from Mike's thing,
with the beats, and then he did the Mickey Avalon stuff. Some of the Mickey Avalon stuff is good.
But I mean, this is more recent. This is Bang Pow Boom album.
Yeah.
And, you know, really, and that was sort of his return with ICP.
That's right, he did those two
after
albums.
After years doing it without him.
And then the last two were with the new crew, different producers.
But, you know, shit, this stuff's all good. I mean, just listen to... Hey, let me play Forever from Mighty Death Pop. I mean, this is not... I mean, this is amazing. This is great.
I don't get how anybody can't say this is really terrific.
Yeah, I mean, this is great, and, you know... Violent J starts rapping, and maybe you go, I'm tuning out then, but Violent J's a good rapper. Like, listen to Violent J.
Yeah.
I mean, listen to this. This is great.
This is one of my favorites.
Yeah, this really is great.
I don't know how they came up with this. I don't know what the idea was.
Well, I know.
Even the video was terrific.
Yeah. Right. And I know I got Mike, there was a song, I can't even get it to here, but it was a song called Tonight that's on the Bang Pow Boom bonus disc, the Nuclear Edition. So it was like a thing that came out later, like the deluxe edition of the album. And there's a Cream sample. in it. And I know Cream because I'm into, you know,
right. Yeah, yeah.
And nice I saw Mike at the record release. And, you know, Mike and I are friendly. And, you know, he'll always talk to me for 5 minutes. And Mike, come here, man. What's that sample from tonight? That's Anyone for Tennis by Cream, right? Nah. I go, no, it's on Clapton's Crossroads box set, and it was on a Cream, I think, an A side. And he's, I don't have any Cream. I don't know what you're talking about. Mike, come on.
Oh,
it's
he
Cream.
Does.
It's
too
a Cream.
Cream.
It's a Cream. Come on, Mike. Nah, that's a, I go, Mike, I busted you. I know the Juggalos don't know Cream, but I know Cream, and you're not, you know, and that's great. And, you
yeah.
know, and still, you know, who would think to take Cream?
Oh, yeah.
And fucking
well, that's the thing about him, too. Is he does know all that. He's got an
encyclopedia.
Of all that old music and so on. And I mean, but you know how he named the Funhouse Studio? He was like, he was
Stooges?
Thinking, exactly.
Yeah, okay,
he
yeah.
needed to name it.
Right.
And he's looking around the studio and because they need it for credits, and he sees a copy of Funhouse.
Oh, okay.
Like, okay, Funhouse.
Funhouse. And then that was, there's an ICP song called The Funhouse as
right.
well.
Yep. Yeah.
The Funhouse was the name of my radio show that I did for them on Psychopathic Radio.
It's a Detroit thing.
Kept the tradition
it's
going.
It's just a Detroit thing.
I got called out by Violent Jan, and he's, you know, that's Mike's thing. And I go, well, I'm just going to use it.
Well,
I mean,
it's
no
a Stooges thing. Let's just take away.
Yeah,
that,
let's just go there. So
yeah, yeah.
So yeah, the but, book is Juggalo, huh? That's
yeah,
the new
Juggalo
project.
Juggalo Insane, Clown Posse, and the World They Created.
Wow.
And it's a lot about the FBI. It walks in between that FBI thing and how that all came about and how it's all about the money, and they picked on the Juggalos. So
absolutely.
So the FBI found it was an easy, or the these local law enforcement agencies were finding it's an easy thing to do to pick on a Juggalo mm-hmm. because they think they're defenseless. Little did they know, though, that they'd get sued and quite a possibly lose.
Yeah, well, yeah. I mean, that's the thing that the recent findings, right? The appellate court is now
kicked it back to the original judge, the original court here, and it'll be a while now because there'll be a lot of filings. But
if they win the suit, what do they win? Is it damages? Is that what ICP is asking for? Or are they just asking?
It's not. There's a number of remedies here, and they wanted the main thing is to have that 2011 gang assessment report mm-hmm. eradicated, and if you can remove it.
Yeah.
Remove all references as best you can.
But I thought there's been new reports where ICP's not mentioned, or is that
that's
not
right.
the case?
That's right. That's correct. Yeah. The 2013 does not mention them.
So.
And so we got another report coming up here, and they won't be on that either.
Mm.
Meanwhile, I mean, but still law enforcement still, you know, hassles the Juggalos.
Absolutely,
there's
yeah.
still seminars. I talked to a cop in Las Vegas this summer who still puts on a Juggalo gang summit. You
okay.
know, where law enforcement people can come
right.
and you can hear about the Juggalos gang.
Yeah.
And they treat it like a gang.
But
still.
It seems like the law enforcement that actually deals with the Juggalos, you know, the ones that are in the towns where the gathering is or where an ICP tour is, when those guys are interviewed in the press anyway, I don't really talk to person. They have nothing but nice things to say about the fans and say, oh, we had one incident or maybe we have a little thing. But it's not like, you know, you go to a Metallica concert and guys are beating the shit out of each other and hitting each other with bottles.
Yeah, it's true. I mean, the ones in Ohio where the gathering's been the last 2 years are fine with them.
Yeah.
But you talk to Hardin County Sheriff's Office in
Illinois,
and Cave and Rock, not so happy.
Well,
still,
they...
Still, like, I'm glad they're gone. You know,
the Hardin County people had it in for... the bikers that own the land.
It was
anyway.
The prosecutor that hated them.
Yeah, they hated him. They hated a Tim York over there, who owned that property, Hog Rock.
Yeah.
They didn't like him to begin with.
Yeah,
and that was because he had a biker fest every year for years and years, even before the gathering ever came in.
Yeah.
And I don't think they liked that thing very much either.
Well, at any rate, it's such an interesting, to me, it's just so interesting, but the whole idea that the Juggalos have been so misunderstood and maligned, and there's no reason, that doesn't seem much of a
Absolutely.
Reason.
And you wrote about the last two gatherings for Daily Beast,
Daily
is
Beast,
that who it was?
Yeah, I write for Daily Beast periodically, I write about five, six stories a year, and I enjoy doing that stuff at the gathering.
Yeah, go read Steve's pieces on the gathering. I'll try to link to those as well, because Steve really, along with that, you know, I told you this, and I don't know if you've ever talked to her, but the other reporter who really, I thought, got it and figured out what was going on there was Camille Dodaro,
oh,
who wrote
terrific.
The
2010 piece
in
Village
The Village
Voice,
and she's written for Gawker and Billboard. And
right,
Spence
she's with Billboard now, but you know, something interesting about that piece, that first piece she wrote.
Yeah.
In Village Voice, was she paid her own way to go there.
Yeah, she just wanted to go.
She wanted to go. And it was going to be a piece in the music section, but it ended up on the cover.
It was the cover of Story. And that sort of, and I've talked to her because me and her are pretty friendly. And you know, she's like, kind of made my career. I got lots of offers. You know, she ended up at Gawker based on her coverage of, you know, ICP and stuff. And,
she's great. Work. She, you know, there's also the guy who did the piece in 2009. I think his name is Thomas Morton. In I think it was Vice.
He did it before.
He did it in 2009.
Yeah, when no one was
and
there.
And he was real funny because I was talking to him, and for the it's in the book, you know, that at this version, I turned in the first version.
Oh, okay.
And so it'll go through several versions over the next 6 to 8 months. But he said, you know, he got there, and they didn't have any provisions for, like, no media pass.
That's what I was going to say. Yeah, that guy.
And he says, well, I made some screw-ups in the article. He goes, but it was like writing the first article on disco. And I thought, what a great
article, he was really at, like, events that, you know, I think there was a wet T-shirt contest, and I was, like, the host for that.
Oh, you saw him?
I think, but that's the thing about that guy. I'm like, who was this guy? There was no reporter hanging around. There was no, he was just there as like a dude. He wasn't, you know.
Well, he said the meanest thing anybody said to him. He thought he was going to be, this is the big misunderstood thing.
Yeah.
No, nobody's going to hurt you. No, everybody wants you to be there.
Yeah, right.
That's the funny part. Yeah. Everybody likes you. And, which is really weird for, especially for someone in the media. But he said the worst he got was somebody called him, Radar O'Reilly or something like that, because he said he looked like he was wearing like nerd, some fatigues or something. He looked like a nerd.
Yeah, I just don't.
And that was it.
Like, because I remember reading that article, and I'm like, okay, there's photos of me in this article taken by a guy that I don't even fucking remember being there. How would this guy get away with it? But I really did love that article. I think it was called "In the Land of the Juggalos." It was on Vice.com.
Yeah, I think
and
that's
it's really good.
It was
that's
really,
a great article.
Really
as well.
Funny. And this guy, when I talked to him about it, he was really cracking me up.
Because then people, you know, have all written these, and that's why I respect what you've done and what Camille has done, because people write that article about the misunderstood juggalo from a sad town, and that is true, but it's also not, it's not what everyone's there for, I think, and I think that you don't have to sort of make it more important than it is. I think you just cover it for what it is.
Yeah, that's right.
And,
exactly.
And sometimes, right, I think these writers, they put more thought into it, and they sort of do this group think where everybody's there for the same reason. Some people are there to get wasted and have a good time, and they like the music. And then there are people who, you know, being a juggalo has helped them through things in their life, and then that's true.
Yeah.
But I don't think that that's the only angle on it, and I don't think that's the only way. You know, and it's not the only way to humanize the juggalo is by telling somebody's hard luck story.
No, not
I think
at
you
all.
Can just go there and say, this thing's fucking fun.
Yeah. That's...
And I think you can cover it that way, and it's perfectly legitimate. You know, this guy, Nathan Rabin, wrote a book, and he wrote a book about, I forget the name of his book, but it was a popular book. It was about different subcultures.
I read it, yeah.
Followed
the one about
fish around,
and, then,
and I forget who else.
But it was more about him.
Yeah, and it was about the gathering, and I met Nathan for the first time this year, and he wrote some stuff in the book, and you know, I'm not, again, I didn't read the whole book, but, you know, did I do a Google book search and find my name in it? Yeah. Upchuck the Clown is in there. So I read what he wrote about me, and his depiction of one of the comedy shows or one of the events I was doing, I thought was completely inaccurate.
Okay.
So I met him this year, and I pull him aside, and I'm like, Nathan, you know, you wrote this book, and I go, you should talk to me. I'll tell you what's going on. It might be interesting to you, because I think my perspective on a lot of stuff is much different than the other psychopathic workers in a lot of ways, because I am an outsider, and because I have sort of a career in show business that's not based on ICP, and so I bring some of that, you know, like what I do at the comedy club, I bring that to the gathering, and I bring some of these. So I have a perspective, and I've worked for rock bands in other places. So, you know, I thought it might be interesting for him to talk to me and get that.
That's right. If a good journalist wants to hear your perspective.
And Nathan said, oh, okay, well, maybe we'll talk in a couple days or whatever. I'll get to you. Said, okay. And then, like, you know, never saw the guy. And then last night we're doing, Judah Friedlander was doing stand-up in the tent, you know, where I was running. And I look out in the crowd, and here's Nathan, completely painted up like Violent J. Just completely in face paint and, like, hanging out. And I don't know if he was drunk or I don't know what he was, but he was just like... And I go, well, he's... I don't think there's any talking to him now.
Are you sure that was him? Really?
Oh, I know it was him. I know it was him.
Wow.
So now I don't know if he, and I'm sure he covered last year's gathering. I don't know if, I don't think I read it.
Who's he writing it for?
Don't know.
Okay. All right.
But somebody, and he's, I'm sure you can find out, but I go, well, maybe this is a guy that, you know, I can't be, if he's going to enjoy himself to the point of
he's painting his face,
and then watching, and then when I say he was at the comedy show, he wasn't like hanging around with a camera and a notebook,
yeah.
He was sitting on a fucking hay bale with the Juggalos watching the comedy show.
That's really cool.
And I go, yeah. All right, well, let's let this guy have fun. And I didn't feel too bad that he didn't talk to me, because I go, all right, this guy is doing what he's doing. He's having fun.
Yeah.
I don't need to sit here and, you know, beat my fist and go, you goddamn it, when you talked about that show I did and you got it wrong. And that's not what I would have been anyway, but I thought I could fill him in on some things that...
That never
probably
hurts.
Never saw.
Yeah,
but,
that never hurts. Yeah,
but he was doing his own thing. So Nathan,
hey man, that's
I forgive you, but
yeah,
I saw you.
Cool.
I saw you incognito, bro. We know.
That's pretty cool.
Don't claim you don't enjoy it, Nathan. Because I saw, I saw nothing, you there enjoying it as a fan.
Certainly nothing wrong with enjoying.
Not
it.
Just a writer. Yeah, all right, a couple quick things before we got to go. Because boy, this is I could talk to you all day.
Yeah, this is kind of fun.
It is fun.
It's like,
but a couple things.
We could get into books. We could get into some
I know,
more music.
Yeah,
could,
music
you know,
stuff.
Yeah.
But just a couple things in Detroit Rock City having really nothing to do with Detroit. But, you know, I'm a big Springsteen fan. I think people know that hear this. I know you've never seen Bruce, right?
I've never seen Bruce Springsteen. I don't even really get him.
But there are some connections in your book, because John Landau is his oftentime producer, manager.
The guy who mangled the second MC5.
That's what I was
going to
ask you about.
And I mean, for some reason, I listened to that album about a week
Did
ago
you?
Again.
Yeah, I listened to a little bit of it, too, and it sounds bad.
Disturbing.
It sounds thin. It sounds like it just doesn't sound like the MC5. Just
How you could do that, how you could suck the life out of a band like so full of life is pretty amazing.
The Springsteen albums he produced sound good. You know, Darkness on the Edge of Town. Well, he had something to do with Born to Run. He was in there for a little bit.
Okay.
But then Darkness on the Edge of Town is where he really sort of took over as a producer. Born in the USA, all that stuff. So
yeah. Well, I mean, when there's all kinds of mitigating circumstances where, like, maybe there's a reason that MC5 album came out so bad.
Yeah.
So it shouldn't just...
Not reflecting on John.
Right.
And
exactly.
Dave Marsh was a writer for Cream. And I know he's from Detroit, and there's lots of Dave Marsh quotes in the book. And Dave Marsh came off as a good guy in the book.
He liked him. He's so crabby that I called him, I think, three different times.
Yeah.
And I think I might have made up a reason the last time, because he's so crabby.
Yeah.
I never knew if he was going to go, I can't talk right now. Hang up. I'm like, that's gold.
Because Marsh.
You know, because I find that really funny. He's crabby in a way that I really like.
In Bruce circles, he is now considered. Well, he wrote the two big bios of Bruce, Born to Run, and one was called Glory Days. And they've said if you get them now, you can get them combined into one thing. Well, at the time, they were the only things we had, you know. So Born to Run came out in 79 or 78 or something, and then the second one came out in like 86 or 85, somewhere around there. So now they're considered whitewashes in a lot of ways. They're very negative on Bruce's original manager, Mike Appel, who was the guy who really discovered Bruce and managed him. And granted, Bruce sued him, and they did have this history that was fraught. And
you got to sue your manager.
It was one of those. But it's really the history that he and he's also like a DJ on the Sirius station, E Street Radio.
Okay.
And the fans, and again, I don't know Dave. I have nothing against him. I read those books. His books have been surpassed by better books now, I think.
As you mentioned,
the Peter Ames Carlin book called Bruce is really good.
Okay.
But he's considered a real putz amongst Bruce Springsteen fans. I mean, they really hate Marsh and think he's an asshole. And I go, I don't really know the guy. And I'm saying, well, you've had some experience. Well, he's crabby, but
I thought he was terrific.
Yeah, okay.
He was funny. He was funny. He was smart.
And plus, he's also considered, you know, his wife is Springsteen's assistant manager, or she's part of the management team. So now it's like he's really in house. You know, now there's no, you cannot feign any objectivity towards Bruce, Dave, because now we know the whole thing. But it's good to hear he's not a bad guy.
Yeah, you know, I don't see, you know, sometimes you see these whitewashes and so on, and it doesn't seem like Bruce Springsteen was a guy that needed to be defended, of course.
But it's just, the legend that they wrote is just, it seems inaccurate now.
Okay.
When you look at it and go, you know, this was the myth and that was the one. And you know, Bruce probably didn't want it. I don't know Bruce, obviously, but you don't feel like he would want that story out there about him, about how what a righteous guy he was and these shady managers and stuff. And that's the thing when you see Peter Ames Carlin's book and he talks about, you know, Bruce's highs and lows and his problems with women and his problems in relationships and mental illness. And Bruce, you know, admits to taking antidepressants, I believe, is what he was on. You know, so okay. Interesting. Yeah. Interesting.
I mean, we like to know the people that are making the art
a
that we listen to.
A deeper dive.
You know, yeah, we like to know the people.
And then a couple last things. You wrote a book about the Ramones.
Or
you,
did.
Did you edit that? What
I worked with Johnny Ramone in the last 6 months of his life.
Okay.
And yeah.
And now
came out as Commando.
Okay. Now, I just have a little, I have some Ramones. Because Ramones are guys who, I can't tell if the Ramones, were they great or were they just...
They were great.
But were they also not... Did people like them ironically, in a sense? Did people go, I'm going to like these minute and a half songs in one chord, and I'm going to go watch that because that's the ultimate fuck you to corporate rockets on the radio? Did it work for them, or were they...
There might have been a little. I mean, yeah. To me, I mean, I can only speak for myself. I mean, when I, you know, you listen to them in the first four albums,
yeah,
and you go, well, this is just great. What are you going to do? I mean, what are you going to do after that?
Yeah.
I mean, unfortunately, they didn't have much after those
exactly,
first four.
Yeah.
Nothing in the tank.
Yeah. Right.
But they kept going. But no, I don't know. People liked them because they were awesome and they were, you know, were they contrived? I don't know. I don't think so.
No?
I don't
think
they were contrived.
I think people think about them as like, oh, well, you know, they would be touring in the 90s and stuff and they'd be on bills with bands that we cared about and we'd be like, oh, it's these old guys playing these 20-year-old songs.
They definitely wore out their welcome.
And they were kind of a one-note act a little bit.
Yeah.
And then I listened to... See, I like the kind of the softer Ramon stuff, which is like this.
Like this? Okay.
And yeah, I love the Christmas song, which I have here. You know, I love this. Merry Christmas, I don't want to play tonight.
Yeah. Okay. Yeah.
I love something like this. You know, this is what I like, you know.
Well, this is later. This is a little
later. This is later, too, yeah.
Yeah, so, I mean, in that case, you could probably hear like some of the stuff you like in later era records.
But I kind of went with the Ramones. It's like, well, you know, you were there, and you know, now, they were completely, were they the most dysfunctional band in the sense of the guys, because you always heard that the guys, even at their height, never got along. And
I don't think they, I mean, that's been well chronicled.
Yeah.
These guys, I just got done reading Marky Ramone's book. It's really, really good.
Yeah.
But yeah, they didn't get along at all.
Okay.
I mean, they just, I mean, Marky was a guy actually who did get along with them and with everybody, or he did his best.
Yeah.
But they were, you know, I mean, I think the fact is, too, that they decided they toured out their life in a van, jammed into one little van. Whereas usually when you get a little bigger later on, you're in.
Yeah, why did they did they just never get that thing?
Save money.
They never saved the money?
They wanted to save money.
Or did they never have that hit where they finally blew up and then they could kind of ride that?
They had the money for a bus.
Did they?
They just took a van and a truck because they wanted to save money.
Oh, God.
Because, you know, you had a big outlay for a big-ass, you know, big-ass touring club. But yeah, they were a terrific, terrific band.
I mean, I'm warming to the Ramones. As I get older, I'm going, well, maybe I like this more. And I don't dislike it. I've never disliked it, but I've always, again, sort of felt
first
like...
First four albums? Yeah, that's what you want to, you know, leave home. Is my favorite.
Okay.
Sounds good.
Well, this has been a blast, Steve. I think we've covered
it.
I mean, not that we can't talk forever, but God, we talked for an hour and 40 minutes.
Hey, it went by like 15. No, that's cool. I don't have anything else to add. You've asked all the questions. You went right down when he asks.
Look at those notes.
Down this list.
I got a whole note.
It's like, you know, it's kind of like being interviewed by the cops. You know.
But Juggalo, that when we expect that next
next summer, hopefully.
Okay.
Yeah. We're like I said. I just turned it in, and we're looking at cover art. We're getting photos together. And
how many, if I may ask, because I think there's a right answer to this, how many Upchuck the Clown chapters, more or less than two? Are we talking, because at least we know one for sure.
There's a full
chapter.
There's
got to be at least one, and then maybe two. You
full 5,000 words just on Upchuck.
I would hope so. I would hope so. I have quite the story.
You know, it's funny when you read it. When I did Detroit Rock City, I had people calling me both times. People going, you know, I talked to you for 2 hours and I'm only one line in the book. I'm like, that's how books are, man.
Yeah, no, yeah. I understand.
So,
I understand.
So, but
yeah. I think I've given you some, and I got stuff, and believe me, I've got things that we've not yet tapped into
I'm
some of the
positive
things.
Positive of that, and you know, it's not too late.
No, absolutely. Let me know. You let me know what you want to know.
Right.
And that's the other thing I want to just say about ICP, because I know Juggalos are going to listen to this show, and I know the way ICP works, and I know that those guys may listen to the show when they find out how much we've talked about it.
Sure.
And this is something, and I don't know that I've ever shared this publicly, but I probably told you. You know, Violent J sent me a text once and said, I forget what the original thing was, and he said, well, you know, I want to say something. He says, you know, how come, you know, you've had every opportunity to trash us. You've had every opportunity. You could say all kinds of bad stuff about this. You're a guy who came in from the outside, and you never say anything bad about us. And I want to thank you for that. And here's what I have to say. And I told him this. I said, I have nothing bad to say.
Yeah.
You know, the reason I don't trash ICP, whereas people would love me to, obviously, is that I enjoy working for them. I enjoy their music, which certainly wasn't the case when I started with them. But as I've learned what it is, I've learned to enjoy it. I have a real good time at the gathering. I've had some of the best times of my life working with those guys. I've met tons of famous people, tons of great comics. I mean, I got to work with Cheech and Chong and Charlie Sheen. None of that would have been possible if not for them. So I can only thank them. I cannot have any regrets or anything bad to say about that. Even when you know, I'm up to my knees in mud and I haven't slept for 24 hours or whatever. I'm never upset working with ICP. I love it. I think they're great. I think you get at least a part of that you see with me. And I just wanted to say that here publicly on the shows.
Yeah, yeah. No, it's the same thing. It's funny. When I started doing the work, the reporting on Juggalo, I told somebody, I said, well, let's see. So far, the first thing that's happened, I've talked to some Juggalos. I had one of them buy me lunch, you know, this kind of thing. And I tried to outline it. And I said, right. I went to the gathering. I had people offering me booze, offering me weed. And, you know, I'm thinking, well, on what planet is this bad?
Well,
why does everybody get so uptight?
And I guess
this?
I'm remiss in not thanking the Juggalos for being as cool as they are.
Yeah.
Because, and you know the history. I had a guy who was trying to kill me at one point. It seemed
By the way,
and that might have been even what the first thing we might have even talked about back.
That,
in the
I think
day.
That might have made it in the book.
But you know, that is an outlier, and that's going to happen to anybody who's. Gets right. famous in any kind of scene.
That's right.
And that's going to happen. But really, I mean, to a man, a Juggalo is really a great guy. And some of my friends, I mean, I have personal friends that are Juggalos that when I go tour and do comedy, they'll come to the show. We'll hang out.
Yeah.
I've had lunch with them. I've done all kinds of things. Always enjoy the Juggalos. Always a good time. I like those guys a lot. I'm not afraid of them. I respect them. Do I get everything they do? Not necessarily, but I accept it, you know? I look at it and go, hey, man, you're having a good time.
Yeah.
I've been to rock shows where people aren't having a good time.
I'm guessing that's probably the way. It seems like, at any rate. Yeah.
I think people miss that, too. And I think when people cover the gathering and people go, why are people into this? Why? You know, what gets people in? It's a good time.
I totally get it.
That's it.
The first thing you get when you're
why
people enjoy it.
And
how ICP created this really cool thing. You see how hard they work at making this happen. Mm-hmm. And this is really... that impressed me too, because I got to watch some of the machinations of this thing coming together.
Yeah,
and I really appreciated watching and seeing how.
Yeah,
you know,
it's just a good time.
Yeah, and there's no corporate sponsors.
Yeah. Don't be afraid of it. It's just a good time.
Yeah,
that's all it is. Like anything else, you hear the history of rock and roll, and that's what it was. It was just people having a good time.
That's it. Yeah.
Woodstock was just people having a good time.
That's right. Feeling it.
Yeah. And it became something else, and people threw a lot of shit on it and made it something else, but it was just all starts out from having a good time.
Yeah.
And this was a good time. Thank you, Steve Miller.
All right, man. My pleasure.
Get the book, Murder in Grosse Pointe Park. That comes out December 1st, Detroit Rock City. A ton of books on Amazon. Go over there. Check those out.
Yeah.
I love it. Thank you, Steve.
All right, man.
All right. We're out of here. Joel Radio. See ya. Goodbye. Go read a book. Stop listening to me. Much better.